Hello, this is Norvin Hobbs here with Tan Stoppel. Today we're going to be discussing alt-Jewing, this recent thing where Jews are trying to work their way into the alt-right, Nathan Coffness's attempts to kind of distract and obscure some of the quote-unquote anti-Semitic talking points that people like us make, and just generally this whole idea of, you know, we can't blame the Jews, and this attempt to pathologize or demonize or mock people that focus on the real problem. So I guess the first thing we can get into, because it's actually the most recent, I don't know if you saw, but Nathan Coffness is now calling out Jared Taylor for not being philo-Semitic enough.
Yeah, well, I just saw that actually a few 10 minutes ago before coming on with you. And I haven't remarked on it yet, but I've been following that whole exchange, his initial criticism of McDonald and the response from McDonald. And then, you know, I went on and talked with Luke Ford mainly about that issue, that attack. And as I said at the time, and he just continues to prove that I was right about it, I said that this criticism of Coffness's is not new. It's really just the same old criticism that's been made all along, and that is not just with regard to McDonald. It's also with regard to Amran and Jared Taylor, that the complaint that Ian Jobling made and that eventually made him leave Amran in disgust was that Jared Taylor was just too anti-Semitic or wasn't active enough about moderating anti-Semitic comments, or, you know, he's basically that he doesn't serve the Jews well enough. And there was another blogger, Unamused, that I wrote about, that he wasn't specifically critical of Jared Taylor or Amran, but he was very critical of Kevin McDonald. And it was, you know, in the same kind of visceral hatred for McDonald that Coffness is taking the same attitude, is basically just exhibiting the same behaviors and making the same kind of childish, silly arguments.
Yeah, he's used the phrase pseudoscience. I think I've caught him using that to describe McDonald 3 or 4 times. And he's been sniping at McDonald and Andrew Joyce for the past week. This man is not behaving like an academic. He's acting like a man with a grudge. He's acting like a goddamn Jew.
Yeah, well, he's... his academic focus is on philosophy, and I didn't think his critique of McDonald was very solid. It wasn't even logical, and it was based on basically attacking McDonald's scholarship. And if anything, I don't know, my attitude is that McDonald goes too far to be to cross every T and dot every I and be fair-minded and academic and everything. And he's not he did eventually, I think, see that Coffness was making a bogus attempt to just basically a sham of a critique that could he and other Jews could then point to and say, see, we discredited this guy, and look, they still believe him. They still are following him. Coffness made it pretty clear that he was acting from the get-go. He was going through this effort in order to basically take down McDonald because he was disturbed by the rising popularity of not just McDonald, but of the quote-unquote anti-Semitism, the rise of anti-Semitism. So in that respect, which is the main respect in which the main way to view Coffness, he is just like the supposed left-wing Jews that he supposedly opposes and points to as his enemy or as, at least his adversary and wants us to think is somehow different than him or that he's different from them. He uses the same type of tactics. He's attacking the same people and for the same reasons. Because he cares mostly about what's best for the Jews. And he just goes about it in a different way, using different tactics and slightly different approaches to the argument.
Yeah, and his argument, I looked at it. I couldn't even stomach reading the whole thing. I looked at summaries. His argument is the same basic bitch argument everyone makes against realism. It was, you know, not salt, not all X are like that. Oh, well, white people are liberal too. And then, of course, he threw in the Jews have super duper high IQs. And we can get into that in a minute. But it's like these arguments wouldn't fly in a normal race realist discussion about blacks. I mean, liberals try to use them. But this idea that, well, you can point to these few Jews that you say supposedly aren't what we're talking about. And you can point to these white liberals. And this is supposed to debunk everything else. It's just absurd. And it's a very basic argument. It's a non-argument. But, you know, since he's a Jew and he gussies it up, everyone kind of feels like they have to debate it in good faith. But again, this is stuff that pink-haired social justice warriors would throw out there when talking about race or immigration. You know, not salt, and white people are bad too.
Yeah, and you already mentioned pseudoscience, that, you know, accusing McDonald of doing pseudoscience, that's the same buzz term that anti-racists have been using since Boaz's day. It's an accusation that applies more to the Jews, trying to wrap themselves in the mantle of science and adopt the authority of science in order to use it. They know that science has a reputation for getting stuff done and for people trusting what is labeled science, that it's based on rationalism and reason and evidence and logic and all of those things that ultimately come from the white man, from the European mind. And they know how to ape it, and they hijack it, basically. I did a long series of podcasts focus on this this issue of race science, the history of race science, and how it was ultimately derailed and hijacked by Jews. That Boaz was just probably the most well-known one and the first and foremost one that pioneered the effort. But after that came a long string of others. I can't even recall all of them now, but it's just, and it continues to this day. I've got a post, an article that I'd like to write at some point here about this current hot topic of race science and the Jew paradigm, or the Jew narrative up until this point, the prevailing anti-racist narrative for the last 100 years, is being challenged in the public Jews media right now by people like Steven Pinker and Sam, what's his name, Harris, and a few others that are swirling around them. And these books that they're putting out, Pinker's got a book out, David Reich has a book out. David Reich is that guy who's working on ancient DNA, the Jew. And it's the to put it in a nutshell, it's basically just an alt-Jew movement. It's what I call intersectional Jewing. It's a bunch of Jews who realize with what they're working on, the science that they're doing, is basically uncovering these facts and realities that are exposing the last 100 years as a pile of bullshit, as a bunch of lies, outright lies, and very harmful lies. It's done untold damage to whites in our societies, these lies. And so they're trying basically to head that off and take the role of the good guys who are bringing, you know, the truth back to academia and the truth back about race. And all it really is just a slight adaptation of the anti-racist line. I mean, they basically agree with the anti-racist that the enemy is the Nazis. The enemy is the real racists, the white people. And you can see that, what's his name? Charles Murray, who's kind of at the center of this whole thing. They keep thrusting him forward as, poster boy for this position, that, you know, this race realist position. I often use that term. In fact, before I started talking about all Jew, I had noticed that race realists like Jared Taylor and Steve Saylor always tended to make excuses for Jews and seemed to always want to conflate Jews as white, to see them as white and just some sort of strange variety of white, when it's the truth is actually that they're complete adversaries. They see themselves as the opposite and demand political treatment that's exactly the opposite of whites.
Yeah, they are different from us. They've always seen themselves as different from us. the thing that they're, I think part of what they're doing with this race thing is the DNA, it's getting to the point where it's absurd to say a race doesn't exist. In a world of 23andMe, ancestry, DNA, we're getting, you know, more stuff out there with archaeology about evolution, migration. The race doesn't exist thing was just, it was not sustainable anymore. Even it was, I think it was starting to cause problems in medicine because it was an article. What did you see it 2 weeks ago? They were saying that refusal to acknowledge race could be damaging to people's health. And other
it could be bad for non-whites. That's the argument that's being made now. Yeah, that's a good point. The very pragmatic, practical result of the ongoing science is that they are discovering that certain medicines either work or don't work on certain races of people. And so race has a very, very important biological aspect to it that's literally life and death. I remember when I did some research on blood transfusions and organ transplants. It's the same thing, basically. They know, the doctors know, that it matters who you take an organ out of and who are you putting it into. Even though at the same time, they pay lip service to this idea that we're all the same under the skin. We all bleed red and our blood types don't matter. The reality is that you're much better off and you have much more of a chance of survival if you get organs donated from somebody in your own family. That's the best of all. But somebody of your own race, who's basically your distant family, is better than getting it from a complete alien. Even if that alien has the same blood type as you, there are other factors. There are other finer factors than just the A, B, O, and positive and negative of blood type that have to be matched. But yeah, I had noticed toward the tail end of doing that work that there were already these arguments being made that for drug treatments, that certain drugs were known to, I can't think of any off the top of my head, but affect heart disease or heart disease, people being treated for heart disease, that it was more efficacious on whites than it was on blacks. And I had actually found a couple of articles where they talked about the morality of this, that the scientists had been so intimidated about race and being called racist and not wanting that they basically ignored race for a lot of their tests. And then what happened was this surprise was revealed that, hey, this drug isn't even working on blacks nearly as well as it works on whites. And why is that? Well, we only tested white people and we didn't see a need to, like, because, hey, we're all the same, right? We only tested white people. And that's how that happened. And of course, when the position is reversed, you know, if white people are dying because of the ignorance of race, you're not supposed to care about that. That's racist to care about that. And you'll get fired from your job if you say, hey, wait a minute, we've got to do something to save these white people. We have to pay attention to race. But when you flip it around, you say, hey, wait a minute, blacks are dying because we're not paying attention to race, then it's okay to pay attention to race. And that's not really a big mystery. That's that a lot of people refer to that as hypocrisy. And it is something that gets people upset, especially if they are under the illusion that we really are all equal or that we all should be treated equally. That sort of liberal mindset that literally what a literal liberal is, somebody who won't even take their own side, who thinks everybody is us. They are outraged by that, but it actually makes perfect sense as I've described it before, the morality, the underlying morality of our current zeitgeist, our current political regime worldwide, is that white people are evil. White people are bad. So anyone who stands up and tries to advocate in favor of white people, even mildly, even just in plain vanilla political terms that don't even really refer to race or the Jews or non-whites in any way, but just says, hey, I think of somebody like Jason Kessler in Charlottesville, they are still demonized and attacked for being a Nazi, racist, you know, all the bigot, all the rest of it. And, you know, on the flip side of that morality, the idea is that non-whites can do no wrong. And immigrant is sort of a proxy for non-white. You know, whenever the Jews media is running an article about immigration, of course, it's always favorable to the immigrant. It's always, they're just good people looking for a better life for themselves and their family. And they're not talking about some Irish family moving or some South African family moving to the United States. They're, of course, they're talking about mestizos or Asians or, you know, some other Africans moving to blacks moving to the United States. That's who they have in mind. And that basic morality, that's not something that white people created. That's something that the Jews created, to bring it back to our overarching topic here. You know, you can try to argue that this morality that I'm talking about, that, you know, labeling whites as the ultimate definition of bad and evil and non-whites as the ultimate good and righteous, you can argue that that doesn't really exist, you know, and they do. That's the first argument they use, is, oh, you're just imagining that because you're a bigot, because you're a white supremacist and you don't like the way things are going. But, you know, you can argue with somebody like that for a little while, and then eventually it gives way to the argument of, well, you're just jealous. Or, you know, you just wish that your race could be as successful as the Jews or some other, you know, basically an acknowledgement that their first approach was bullshit, that it was not what they really believed. And that's the point, is that the Jews have created this morality. It has a very long history to it. It's not something that happened just recently. It didn't just happen in the 60s. It didn't just happen with Franz Boas in the 1920s. It goes back way, way back. I mean, as far as you want to trace back history and there's any hint of the Jews being present, they're doing the same sorts of tricks.
Yeah, they have pushed, you know, this slave morality, this worship of the broken, all the way back to Christianity, and probably older if you really were able to get into some of the ancient civilizations.
Yeah, I think it was Revolo Oliver that really delved as deeply into that as I've ever seen anyone go. The origin of the Jews and the origin of Christianity and the overlap of those two things. And it was either Revolo Oliver or Kevin Strom reading Revolo Oliver or Kevin Strom's original ideas, but it basically pointing out that this is the main Jewish trick is moralizing, what I would call moralizing, you know, defining good and bad, not just for themselves, but also for the peoples amongst whom they've embedded themselves, the people, their host, that they've infiltrated and are in the process of manipulating. That is the manipulation. That's the main mode of manipulation that they've used historically. You know, before there was television and film, and before there was radio, and before there was even the printing press, going all the way back, if you know, media was basically the religious beliefs and the holy word, the holy books. That was media, or at least the equivalent in the ancient history of what we call media today. Today it's blossomed and, you know, invaded transmuted into lots of different forms. But that's their control over media I trace it back to this moralizing that they've always done. And they're still doing that today. And that's my point about this basic morality that helps you to understand everything that's happening today, is that, you know, whites are bad and non-whites are good. This is distributed by the Jewish media, and, you know, without describing it as such, just implicitly, it's sort of cooked in, it's baked into every one of their articles. And even though organized religion is melting away, that morality is, that simple anti-white morality is actually growing stronger.
Well, yeah, it's been so deeply embedded at this point, they don't really need the vehicle of religion.
There is a new religion. It's Holocaustianity, or, you know, just outright worship of the Jews.
Yeah, that is true. It seems like what they've done is, you know, they first, before there was multiracialism, it was, they used the poor, they used the broken. It was always a morality based around worshiping, you know, the broken is the expression. And, you know, as they've moved along, they've turned it into helping the stranger was helping, you know, some beggar from another village all the way to now, you know, helping these most alien people that it could possibly be. And now even these weird subgroups like trans people and just gays. It's these people somehow are inherently morally good for not being normal. Normal is wrong. Normal is privilege. And the people that are not normal by default have this inherent moral superiority. And this goes all the way back to this, like they pushed since the New Testament.
Yeah, well, some people, they use the phrase gaslighting maybe too much, but they're getting at something that's real, and that it's this, I wanted to say there's this term or this famous saying, whom gods destroy, they first drive mad. And this is where, again, I think this really is just a natural consequence of the underlying morality and their underlying understanding that they stand apart from everyone else, especially from whites, and that they don't have any sympathy for whites. They don't feel any togetherness with whites. Some of them see value in keeping whites around. That would be the alt Jews of today that are trying to infiltrate and take over what it means to be a white nationalist, what it means to be white, what it means to be pro-white, what Jared Taylor should do with Ameren and what the Daily Stormer should write about or shouldn't write about. You know, basically they're very forthright or pushy about telling other people exactly how to serve them best.
Yeah, that's, you know, they come in and it's not like they just want to come in and be a part of a pro-white movement. They want to come in and they want to lead. You know, Nathan Kaufman has pointed to the fact that it was like 40% of the speakers at first Ameren were Jewish as proof Jews are so pro-white. My response would be they weren't this large percentage of the attendees. They were this large percentage of the speakers. They came in to lead, to misdirect it.
That's a good point, that they were the speakers, and that not just that, that they were there not for the pro-white purpose that Kaufness wants us to think. And, you know, he knows this, that they were there because they thought what they were doing was best for the Jews. That they think Kaufness and those types of Jews, Lawrence Oster comes to mind, think that, or Oster's dead now, but that's famous. He was kind of an iconoclast, or not an iconoclast, but just an oddball Jew in that he bucked their predominant attitude about whites, which is the anti-racist attitude that whites are to be suppressed and replaced. You know, the borders are to be opened and all the white countries, former white countries, have to be non-white now. And these, what would you call them, opponents, the alt-Jews, have risen because they're, like Oster said, they think that America, with a white majority, is the best environment the Jews have ever had, that they thrive under these conditions. And I don't doubt them that that's what they're, that the Jews have thrived under America in the post-World War II era. And that's all that these alt-Jews, the kind that showed up at the Ameren thing, want to accomplish by going there. And they wore their Jewishness on their sleeve. That's the other aspect of it, is rather than trying to hide their Jewishness, they wanted credit for their Jewishness. They wanted to be there openly as Jews. And the reality is Kaufness, the way he tells the story, and this is like, Ian Jobling, he describes Ameren as being, you know, too anti-Semitic at this point. That's the same thing Jobling was saying 10 years ago. And at that very first conference, David Duke got up and challenged all of these Jews that were there in a fairly oblique, you know, not a very confrontational way, but just basically laid it out there that, you know, how can we talk about Jews being the problem? I don't want to put words in his mouth. But basically, I thought he did a good job of calling attention to the fact, here we are at a conference talking about what's best for white people, and we've got all these Jews here. What's going on with that? Or, you know, can we just acknowledge that Jews are an adversary, are a negative influence? And that's when he was shouted down, and ultimately Taylor, I think, banned him from coming to any future Amran conferences. You know, the Jews flipped out and they got their way in the end. It wasn't Taylor didn't go with the Nazis and ban all the Jews. Taylor went with the Jews and banned all the Nazis.
Yeah, and now it's kind of come back to bite him because I guess because he was at one event with Kevin McDonald and he like said something in support of some activism Identity Europa did, now the Jews are screeching at him. And it sounded like Nathan Confidence wants him to come out and condemn everything. It's like I don't understand how someone like Jared Taylor could be in his position for so long and maintain this philo-Semitic idea. I've heard people say he's faking it. I know Don Black says behind closed doors that is his real position, that he does believe Jews aren't the problem. I don't know if I believe that or not. Who knows? But it's so strange to see the guy that is so anti-Semitic now being targeted by the alt-Jew for not being pro-Jew enough.
Well, look, what I noticed about Taylor's arguments, and I have listened closely, not recently, but I've listened in the past to what he had to say when he was put on the spot about the Jews at a handful of times in the past. And it's typical of what I call the suicide meme. It's this making excuses for the Jews and shifting the blame to whites, which in order to do that, you need to see that there's a distinction between whites and Jews, right? You have to make the distinction and say, these people are not to blame, the Jews, and these people are to blame, whites, right? And that, when Taylor does that, he's contradicting his own arguments that Jews are white, that we're all one happy white family. And it was the same thing I had noticed years before with Lawrence Oster, the Jew who would do the same thing. He would talk about Jews as if they were just white people. And he would talk about white liberals. And in that he included both white liberals and Jew liberals. And then at other times he would acknowledge that the Jew liberals actually had a completely different set of thoughts going through their head. They were being Jew liberals because they thought that was the best thing for the Jews. And the white liberals were doing things because they wanted to demonstrate that they didn't care about their own people.
Yeah, the way they argue is different. White liberals have been gaslit into this morality. They've been sold these lies. They don't care about themselves. But the Jews, when they're liberal, it is ultimately self-serving and always has been.
Yeah, that's the point I wanted to make about gaslighting. That, first of all, gaslighting requires two parties. Again, Jew and white is the analogy I've made, that if you want to see the relationship between Jews and white and understand it in terms of gaslighting, you've got the other essential element, which is that the one partner in the relationship trusts the other one, who is a sociopath, who is doesn't trust the other one, and in fact wants to exploit the other one. So, you know, it's easy to see how this gaslighting arises so much between whites and Jews, because you've got whites who basically, and you could criticize whites in various ways for doing this, but it's a real phenomena that they just think of Jews as nothing special, as just other white people. That's one of our main failings, that we don't recognize these enemies who they clearly, when you pay attention to what the Jews are saying about the Holocaust, about blood libel, about the whole history of Jews amongst Europeans, they tell it pretty clearly as an adversarial relationship. They see it as two existential enemies struggling with each other for survival. Of course, they always flip it around. If from their point of view, they're the good guys and we're the bad guys. And that's how I understand a lot of this, what people refer to as gaslighting. The Jewish media is gaslighting us on this or that, meaning they're telling the opposite of the truth, that what we know is going on. We see the Jewish media saying the opposite, and that tends to drive people crazy. They see somebody blatantly lying, and they go, wait a minute, that's not right. And in the first stages of gaslighting, when it's first happening, when the one partner is lying to the other about what they're up to and what's going on, it tends to drive you crazy, until you come to realize somehow that this is an abusive relationship, and you have to just get your mind right about this person that you're loving and trusting and liking and doing things for is abusing you. And that's how you end it. You change your mind first, and then you leave. You put some distance between you and that person, or you take care of them in some more, abrupt way. A more final solution to the problem.
Yeah. The thing that really kind of bugs me with this whole thing is you have these Jews coming in claiming that they're fighting for whites, but all they're doing is blaming whites, kicking whites, talking about how pathetic whites are. I've noticed this argument. Luke Ford is not racially Jewish. He did it a few times, and it really annoyed me. You know, they try to step around this idea that people can be influenced by media, by outside forces, and try to argue, well, whites are to blame because we're doing it. It's like we gave consent. And when you try to point out, well, that's not true because of all this influence, then they want to say, make snide comments about, oh, well, white people must be so pathetic if a few Jews can control them. Did you hear that when Luke Ford made that comment?
Yeah, I've heard that argument many, many times. And the fact is, if our arguments weren't effective and didn't have some substance to them, they wouldn't bother trying to argue with us. But even I remember years ago, a decade ago now, this kind of talk that we're having was a very marginal thing. There were only a handful of places on the internet that you could find it, even though the internet was more wide open in some respects. The hammer hadn't dropped on free speech yet, but it was still fairly rare to find it. And yet, even in those rare marginal places where only a handful of people were gathering, there would be the troll, the Jew, the disinfo guy, and somebody was always there trying to stir trouble, trying to sow confusion, just denying things that had, the famous quote of Hitler's about arguing with the Jews, that, you'd devastate them and their arguments and destroy them, take them apart one day, and then the very next day you'd show up and the same Jew would act like it had never happened. It would just be arguing the same thing all over again. That's just how they are. You know, that's another thing that I've harped on quite a bit in the past, is we are not the same. Racially, they are different, not just in appearance and subtle differences that are visible, but they're different in their thinking patterns. They have different personalities. They have seemingly a complete lack for any, they know how to appear objective, and they know that that can sway white people and other people, this appearance of scientific objectivity, but they don't really actually try to be objective. And you can see that anytime an argument about, Israel the attitude of Jews towards Israel versus their attitude about the borders of the United States or any other white country have to be open. They have to be liberal. They have to be tolerant of minorities. It's the other thing that liberalism means to Jews is this idea that minorities have to be protected. Most of all, it's sort of an Animal Farm type thing where the idea is, we're all equal, but some minorities are more equal than others. It's double think and double talk. And so much of what the Jews do is just outright lies that we could not imagine ourselves telling. We wouldn't have the stomach to do it. We wouldn't think we could get away with it. And even if we could get away with it, we would torture ourselves for being so dishonest. But part of that is part of what gives the Jews the strength to do that is they see Jews as what they care about. And where they might not lie to a fellow Jew, they don't have any problem really lying to whites and telling whites whatever they think will get the job done. Whereas whites tend to have the opposite attitude of, well, these Jews, if I could just convince them with my arguments and be as honest as I can, as upfront as I can, then maybe they'll join our side. The kind of white person who gravitates toward Amran because it sounds reasonable. And even McDonald just today, I think, posted some comment in response to Koffness's latest ravings that.
I did
comment about that because it was kind of strange. He just seems discombobulated by, I forget what the word was I used, flustered by Koffness's just flat out distortion of reality, inversion of reality. And instead of just brushing it off or mocking and pointing out what Koffness is doing, he tries to react to it and instead, says, Koffness's accusation was that McDonald predicted that Jews wouldn't try to be pro-white. McDonald's response was, "Oh, I've never said that. And I've always said that the alt-right should be open to the Jews." And sure enough, he's actually had that attitude. He's given writing slots to alt-Jews to come and write articles at the Occidental Observer. One of them was literally about what's best for the Jews, making the argument that being an alt-Jew is what's best for the Jews, which is just bizarre. I still can't wrap my mind around McDonald, who knows so much about what the Jews do and how they do it, why he would accede to that. But he linked to an article that he had written several years ago when the alt-right was just first appearing on the scene under the name alt-right. And he was the point of the article was about how Jews have historically infiltrated and undermined white political movements. And I think the specific example was he quoted Sam Francis talking about how the paleocons were, how conservatism was hijacked by neocon Jews. And then all of the paleocons were like pushed out of the movement. They were no longer allowed to be conservatives anymore. They were marginalized. And then he quoted somebody later, I think it was Andrew Joyce writing about some other example of that. And, so the point, even if McDonald himself didn't make it explicit, the point of it was you shouldn't let Jews, be involved in any way. And not this attitude of because a Jew complains about anti-Semitism that you say, "Oh, no, I'm not anti-Semitic." That's the, that gets close to what I call the kick-lick syndrome or the kick-lick phenomena in politics, where you see the Jews accuse a politician of being an anti-Semite, a politician or a celebrity of some sort, and what do? Their reaction is to grovel and try to prove then for the rest of their life to the Jews that they are the best friends of the Jews. They bend over backwards to lick the boots of the Jews. So it's not, I don't think McDonald goes that far, but I mean, that's the basic criticism I had back when I was talking about pathological altruism, that McDonald kind of absorbed or adopted from Jared Taylor and then started bringing up pathological altruism whenever he was being critical of the Jews. He would make some criticism of the Jews in some article he was writing, and then he'd go, "But we have to remember that it's not purely the Jews that are the problem. White people are the problem too. We have this pathological altruism." And then he'd link to a story of his own where he was like talking about Noel Ignatieff or something, that infamous anti-white Jew at Harvard. It's this need that, and again, back to our main topic here about, who's to blame for this stuff, and this tendency of whites to want to be fair-minded with an enemy, to not even recognize the enemy as an enemy, and instead treat them as if they are a potential ally, as if they've just maybe been mistreated a bit too much. Maybe we've been too harsh on the Jews for the past few centuries, and if we just treat them better, that they'll join our pro-white organizations and help us defeat the Muslims and the mestizos and the Negroes. And it's just fantasy. It's wishful thinking that even if it was happening for the first time, it would seem foolish. But it's actually, we've already got a long history that we can look at of people, white leaders, white intellects, advising that we try that and the disaster that it produces. There's no reason to go through it again.
Well, yeah, I remember, what was it, 2-3 years ago, this happened not to this level, but you had people like reactionary Jew, and I can't remember the girl's name, Rachel something, trying to kind of get into the movement, talking to Red Ice. You had people like Golden One saying, blaming the Jews for everything is degenerate. And that's kind of when Kevin McDonald, I remember when he came out with this pathological altruism thing. So even since the alt-right has began, they've tried this, and it didn't quite take that time. I'm not exactly sure what happened, but it stopped for a while, and now they're coming back to it.
Well, I'll tell you what happened, what I think happened. First of all, McDonald didn't create pathological altruism. As I said, he just adopted that terminology, and he got it from Jared Taylor. Jared Taylor was the popularizer of the term pathological altruism as a criticism of whites. And Jared Taylor got it from a woman that had appeared on Red Eye several years ago. And what she was talking about was something different. She was talking about, I remember distinctly, her example of pathological altruism was the white people who voted for Hitler. Okay, that was her understanding of what it meant to be pathologically altruistic. And you know, literally what the term means in biological terms is altruism is when you do something that might harm yourself, or it's a giving of yourself to the benefit of others. And it makes sense biologically when you give of your own resources in order to benefit your offspring or your close relatives, because you are, in a genetic sense, you're helping your own genes to survive, right? That's ordinary altruism. And there are examples of it. It's kind of controversial because there were biologists in the past who said, no, there's no such thing as altruism. There's nothing in nature that's altruistic. It's all selfish. And even the genes themselves, that was the thing about Richard Dawkins. His point was that it's even below the level of an individual. It's the individual genes themselves are selfish. I go off on such tangents, I forget where I was going with that. But pathological altruism. Taylor took that term pathological altruism and he said, this is like an inborn tendency for white people to just do things that harm the white race for the benefit of non-whites. And it's just part of our genetic makeup. It's our biological thing. You know, it's a sciencey explanation for why whites, I don't know, don't rise up and kill the leaders who betray them, who open their borders. Don't genocide the Jews. Don't just gas 6 million Jews. You know, that requires an explanation. Why don't we do that? And the irony of the people who that kind of argument appealed to, this idea that, oh yeah, whites are sort of, it's like original sin almost. Whites are just born stupid. We're born to lose. We're born to get walked all over by non-whites. Because we have this inborn tendency to want to just give away all of our stuff. And my criticism when McDonald started, I didn't really even notice it when Taylor was using the term because I wasn't paying attention to Taylor anymore. I had already basically understood that he's making excuses for the Jews. He's not teaching people or exposing people to what's really going on. He's covering it up. And when McDonald started to use the term, I tried to trace it back. Where did this come from? What's going on? Oh, yeah, all right. So he actually printed an article. I think it was in an issue of Occidental Quarterly or I don't forget the details now, but he was the general topic was white pathology. And I think Taylor's paper on pathological altruism was one of those papers. And then after that, McDonald himself started using the term in the way Taylor had described it as this sort of just so story about why whites open our borders to the refugees. And my criticism back then, it was like 2015, early 2015, that I really became critical of this whole concept of pathological altruism. And I pointed out that there's, you know, they're pointing at cat ladies, and this, which is a real tendency. There are people that are, you know, basically stupid and giving of themselves to the point where they have a brood of a dozen or two dozen cats in their house, and it stinks, and it's horrible living conditions, and they're single. They can't find a mate because they're so screwed up in that way, and they die alone and unhappy and whatever. And they're terrible people in that respect, but that they don't make the policies about the border. They don't welcome them. They may welcome the refugees. They may even go out in public and hold a sign that says refugees welcome, but they're not the ones making the decision about which laws get enforced by the police and which ones don't, and which plane load of aliens gets allowed to unload and which ones don't. So what I pointed out is that the people at the highest positions of political power are actually traitors. You know, they're either aliens themselves, in which case it makes sense that they want to open the gates for more aliens. But they're the ones who are white racially are just obviously more interested in personal reward, and they are either ambitious or they're just, they want power. They want the money. They want the fame that goes with being a good goy and opening the borders, like the Jews who pay for their campaigns want them to, and like the media wants them to do. And, so the problem there is not that they care about the non-white, you know, the people who aren't their own kind, or even that they want to screw necessarily their own kind. It's that they don't care about their own kind. They want to try and even demonstrate that they don't care about their own kind by doing these kinds of things, and that they do care mostly about themselves. And that's what's really, you know, the key to understanding why they do what they do, because they've lost any sort of racial feeling, any sort of sympathy for their own kind. They think of themselves as detached from their own kind, as able to survive without their own kind.
Well, yeah, a lot of the leadership, you know, they're very Machiavellian, borderline psychopathic. I think, you know, birds of a feather flock together. A lot of these, you know, Gentiles by blood that are quote unquote at the top working with the Jews are probably psychologically very similar. You know, just kind of selfish, kind of narcissistic. I've even noticed with Luke Ford, you know, he's not Jewish by blood or so he claims, but he sounds and talks very Jewish. And I heard somebody was telling me, and I heard him talk about it himself a little. He actually has diagnosed narcissistic personality disorder.
Yeah, which is what's behind the gaslighting phenomena. When you have a person that's willing to abuse another person, lie to them and manipulate them and exploit them, like that, that is usually the diagnosis, is that they have narcissistic personality disorder. Yeah, I think in Ford's case, either he's a Mischling himself and just hasn't been upfront about that, or maybe isn't aware of it, or he has just absorbed it through osmosis because he admires Jews. I mean, by his own testimony, when I was talking to him, he converted because he admired Jews. He looked at what they were saying and doing, and he wanted to be around them. And he has, you know, by being around them, and he's adopted their patterns of thought, their ways of arguing, and sympathizes with them. He's rooting for them to win in this conflict. And he's either, you know, consciously or unconsciously, he's deluding himself that somehow we can find some way to just all get along. That's not what's going to happen in the long term. One group or the other will put an end to the other one. That's the way it works in nature. And even amongst parasites that don't outright kill their hosts, it's not always a stable relationship. And in fact, I would make the point that a lot of these people, all Jew types especially, but there's a lot of people who posture as if they're pro-white too, especially the ones that make these arguments that we shouldn't talk about the Jews so much, as if that's the problem, that we're talking about the Jews too much. They're basically what I would say is a moderating force. They're basically trying to normalize the parasitic relationship. They just want it to go back to like it was in the 1960s or 70s or 80s, or, you know, pick some point in the past when the Jews weren't so obvious, when the Jewing and the harm that the Jewing was causing was so obvious as it is today. And they want it to go back and be happy again, when Jews can pretend that they're white and whites go along with the whole thing and the Jews are thriving like they used to.
Yeah, you know, what they want is they want what's best for Jews. And I don't even think long-term any of these alt-Jews really believe that whites continuing to exist is long-term good for them. I think their attitude is now is not the time for us to be gotten rid of.
Yes, it's a very pragmatic attitude, that the anti-racist Jews, basically, they don't like white people, and we can't be gone soon enough for their tastes. And that's the bulk of Jews. And then you've got all of these Jews that are saying, wait a minute, maybe it's a little too soon. You know, it sure is nice having the white U.S. military, the predominantly white and competent U.S. military, to send around the world stomping out our enemies for us and you know, keeping the world safe for Jewry. But there's another point I wanted to make here before I forget it, that goes back to what we were just talking about before and this, which is mixed Jews, you know, the mixtures, the mishlings, the products of their infiltration biologically, where they've actually, you know, what Luke Ford tried to present it as is the oy vey, you know, the Jews are breeding themselves out of existence with all this intermarriage. And what I tried to point out, I don't know how effective I was at it, but this intermarriage doesn't harm the Jews as nearly as much as Koffness or Ford or any of these other alt Jews try to argue. The sky is not falling on the Jews. They don't really have a problem in the core of their gene pool with reproduction. And they've, after all, they've got an ethnostate that is all about preserving the Jewish gene pool and their reproduction. So even if they were to go extinct everywhere else, they'd still have that ethnostate. But the fact is that these mixtures and so many of, it's hard to tell even when you look at these people, these traders, you know, to be able to tell the alien from the trader, it's almost not worth it anymore. Thinking back to this point I was making about when the invasion of, or the big, the invasion's been going on for decades of Europe, but when it really, peaked in 2015, when suddenly boatloads of quote unquote Syrians were showing up from Libya, you know, sub-Saharan Africans on boats, and you see these leaders, and I was making this point about pathological altruism. This is not a, something that the grassroots Europeans demanded. We need more Africans in this country. We need more Syrian refugees. That was not why that was happening. It was because the leaders at the top were betraying the people that they were supposed to be representing. But that's the basic lie of politics, of current day politics, is that the politicians are, you know, in a democracy are supposed to serve the will of the people. But how many of those politicians that were doing that are actually crypto Jews or part Jews? You know, Angela Merkel, there's a cloud around her, what her heritage is exactly. Is she a complete Jew who just denies it, or is she some part Jew or whatever? What's his name? The Sutherland guy from Ireland was at least part Jewish. But, you know, there's also markers you can look for where, you know, when you mention Luke Ford, it's sort of like Luke Ford. You know, Luke Ford, whatever he is, he thinks and talks like a Jew and makes arguments in favor of the Jews. He has adopted the Jewish narrative of history, the oy vey, the 6 million, the Jews have been oppressed for their whole history by, and who oppressed them? The Europeans. And so you see, there was one in particular, Wickstrom, I think was her name. It was a Swedish politician who had this sort of European looking face. I don't think she's even partly Jewish, but she, in trying to justify why Europe needed more refugees and why Sweden had to open its border to refugees, she cited the Holocaust, you know, because of what happened during the Holocaust to the poor Jews. We don't want that to happen to the poor Syrians. And so when they're basically they're exposing their own Jewish reason, their own Jewish rationale, their own Jewish thinking for doing what they're doing. So it doesn't matter whether they're fully Jewish or half Jewish or just thinking like a Jew. They're talking like a Jew. You know, it's the walks like a duck, quacks like a duck sort of thing. It's a duck at a certain point.
Well, yeah, definitely. And I mean, if you go back through history, Jews have been mixing, especially with the elite, for a long time. I maintain that probably most of the royal families at this point are crypto Jews in Europe. Probably a substantial number of our politicians, because I mean, this is what they do. They mix and they infiltrate. And if you really think about them as parasites, it makes sense to have a percentage of them mix. And when times get rough, to actually have more of them mix. You know, it's a way to cling to the host. It's a way to blur the lines between Jew and Gentile. And it's a way to create emotionally compromised people that maybe can see there's a problem, but because of whatever, you know, don't want to speak out.
Yeah. And that's the effect it has. The people who mix with the Jews generally become apologists for the Jews. that's the general tendency. I don't feel compelled to defend the Jews. I don't know why exactly. I should examine that sometime. You know, what is it exactly that makes my attitude different about the Jews? And I would say it's at least partly because my wife is only half Jewish and she doesn't, you know, she's not, thinking like a Jew. There are certain traits. I can see certain personality traits that are very Jewish. This, you know, being very, willing to tell other people what to do, in order to please you is a sort of characteristic of Jews. They have no, compunction about doing that, making up rules that other people have to abide by, you know, because you want them to do those things, and then coming up with rationales for them that it's somehow for everybody's good that these things be done. Not to say that my wife is like that she's a shrew or something, but I do see those kinds of personality things that are in her, but they're weakened. And that's, I guess, the point I would make about the subtle distinctions between a full Jew, a Michelin type Jew, and a non-Jew who's just adopted a Jewish way of thinking or a sympathy for Jews, an extended phenotype in Richard Dawkins' terminology, is that you can see this gradation from, you know, the pure Jew who's basically, ruthless in their arguments. I mean, they'll argue that black is white and white is black. And then the next day, come back and argue the exact opposite if that's what serves their purpose. And they do it without even flinching. And then you've got the Mischlings who are kind of less expert at doing that. There's various ways that, you know, you can see it sort of makes sense. This one, they're not as ruthless. They're not as what's the word I'm looking for? Unscrupulous.
Chutzpah. They don't quite have the chutzpah to look you in the eyes and tell you the sky is green.
Yeah, chutzpah is another word. Yeah, that describes a pure Jew's attitude of just doing what they think needs to be done. You know, and once they decide it's got to get done, they just do it. It's easy for them. The reaction to criticism of Jews is also one of those things that pops out, that a full Jew just gets a visceral reaction in their stomach of disgust, and they can hardly talk about any critic of Jews as if they're even a human being. It's just like a switch flips in their head. The minute they figure out that somebody is criticizing the Jews, it's like just silence that person, demonize that person in some other way, you know, make them go away. Whereas Mischlings are a little bit more conflicted. They're less liable or less likely to go that far. In fact, the one I was talking about earlier, Unamused, who had his meltdown, his whole shtick was that, hey, I'm okay with the Nazis. I'd rather have a Nazi living next door to me than a Negro. And, he was writing along, you know, stuff along those lines for quite a while, before somebody finally pushed back on him and challenged him about all the horrible things Jews do, and, you know, basically gave him a taste of what a real National Socialist critique of Jews is. And then he lost his composure finally, and the whole pretense about, hey, I'm a pro-white half Jew, that just melted away. And you could see that his main concern was in defending the Jews as a group, as a monolith, as a collective, all of them, because of his good works in helping white people. That was his goal, was to basically win a place for Jews amongst whites in the future white utopia, you know, white, lowercase white in quotes, you know, the kind of whiteness that includes Jews as fellow whites. And that's Nathan Koffness is doing the same thing. You know, he presents that argument about Amren having 4 out of 10 speakers being Jews, the very first conference, as an argument explicitly that, hey, see, the Jews were trying to be pro-white. And then the reality is, when push comes to shove, when anyone tries to argue back with him, it's like, oh, you're an anti-Semite. And, look at this. Jared Taylor is an anti-Semite because he's, you know, fraternizing with, Identity Europa, which doesn't, allow Jews in their organization. The whole goal of not just the Jews who were at the first conference, but of Koffness is basically what's best for the Jews, that they think that the whatever thing that they want to call pro-white and whatever activity that Jews are doing that's pro-white is really all about sniffing out and combating anti-Semitism, which is basically the same thing that Abe Foxman or that Greenberg Jew does today.
Well, yeah, and I think also individual Jews probably just are self-interested and, you know, they don't want to get caught up when the hammer comes down. I think the historical equivalent is Jews that would convert to Christianity to get to stay. I think there's probably in their psyche somewhere still the idea of, if I just adopt the Goyim dress, they'll let me stay when they kick my cousins out.
Yes, and that's a historic pattern of theirs, that they have done that. That half of them, you know, or some large fraction of them flee with as much as they can carry, and the other some large fraction of them basically try to blend in, do the 23 Skidoo. Yeah,
and it kind of goes along with the mixing. I think a lot of Jews are aware, you know, there is kind of a target on their back that's growing on our side with the alt-right and kind of the pro-white criticisms, and on the left with Israel just being a blatant exterminationist state of their neighbors. I think that a reason a lot of Jews are maybe quote-unquote assimilating, getting away from Jewish identity, mixing out, is they don't want to be seen as Jews, because again, I think almost on an epigenetic level, they can sense when things are going in the wrong direction for them.
Yeah, I think that there's a small fraction that basically are disgusted by what their tribe's doing, and they don't want to be part of it. And there are lots of those, maybe not lots, but I can think of lots, because everybody tries to point to them as exemplars. See, here's a good Jew, here's a good Jew. Gilad Otzman is one of those kind of Jews that, you know, pretended that he could just renounce his Jewishness. You know, it's based on a lot of them are basically lying to themselves, maybe, but certainly they're telling a lie, that this idea that a Jew can basically stop being a Jew by just not doing their religious things anymore or not calling themselves a Jew anymore. And I'm not surprised that some of them want to just run away from it. And we will probably see more if the heat ever gets turned up any more on the Jews. There'll be more of these Jews that flock, try to abandon their Jewishness, or that try to flock to the alt-right or to whatever rising nationalist movements there are, and want to basically get themselves into a position where they can make sure that the retribution, that the reprisals against the Jews once they are pushed out of power are not as severe, or at least for themselves, but they also have these, you know, unamused motivations where they'll tell you explicitly, I'm not doing this for the Jews, but at the same time they'll say that they are. They'll reveal in their acts or the manner how they describe what they're doing and why, it's clear that they are doing it because they feel tribally, they feel loyal to their own tribe.
Right, and a lot of what it is just trying to open the door for more Jews. Nathan Kaufman has tweeted out, when Kevin McDonald made that silly tweet about, oh, if some Jews are okay, he said, it's ancient alt-writer / at Richard Spencer, your most important intellectual, Kevin McDonald, says that you should welcome Jews into your movement. Indeed, it would be nonsense not to.
Yeah, no, it's nonsense actually to do it, because it requires a fundamental misunderstanding of the relationship between whites and Jews. You have to basically pretend that Jews are potentially, if not white, then allies of whites. And it's just not true. I mean, there's been a handful of traitors to the Jews over the centuries. Again, Revel Oliver talked a little bit about this phenomena. But what's remarkable about treason, racial treason, for when it comes to Jews, is it's remarkable for its rarity. And even the ones like Gilad Otzman, who some people want to credit with being an authentic traitor, aren't really so much trying to basically betray their people. They're just trying to get away from being associated with them. They're in their own way trying to do what's best for the Jews by basically saying, hey, I'm a righteous ex-Jew. I'm critical of the Jews. See what I'm doing? And get credit for doing it. I mean, here's the thing about what any Jew who sympathizes with white people for whatever bizarre biological reason they would do that, or a half Jew or some other part Jew that's at least partly white that thinks, well, you know, I also don't like what the Jews are doing and I want to help in some way. Okay, well, help in a quiet way, help in an indirect way, help in a way, send money to somebody that you think is doing a good job, or go attack the Jews for what they're doing. But and maybe there is some of that going on and we just don't know about it because they don't identify themselves as a part Jew or a righteous Jew who wants to do what's right by white people, and they just go do their thing and attack Jews. But that's what I would recommend to them if they're saying, well, what do you expect me to do? Don't do what Koffness is trying to do, which is tear down McDonald, discredit McDonald, attack McDonald, and because he's worried about the rise of the alt-right. Don't try and infiltrate and take over positions of leadership and being a spokesman, because that's not where you belong. You shouldn't be doing that.
No, that kind of just shows that they're in it for some ulterior motive. You know, if they really cared, they would be fine being on the sidelines in a supportive role. The fact they want to get into leadership says that they want to direct it in some direction, you know, somewhere they think it needs to go. And that place is never good for white people. Wherever Jews want to go with anything, it never ends well for us.
Yeah. And one of the ways that they try to take it is to basically shut down any criticism of the Jews or even any attention being given to the Jews. And they do it in a very characteristic way by psychological tricks through psychopathologizing, basically calling anyone who does what they don't like, in this case, criticizing Jews is the prime example. They just call them crazy. You're insane. And psychology, modern day psychology was largely constructed on that foundation. It's not all psychologists are Jew quacks who are just looking for reasons to identify anti-Semitism as some sort of mental illness. But a lot of them are, and you could say that psychology, in the same way race science, biology, has been hijacked by Jews who were trying to do what was best for the Jews, that psychology was certainly hijacked in that way. And that's the basis of most of their argumentation. When you argue with a Jew, if you should, you know, need to learn that lesson, you will find that they're just basically going to argue with you long enough to either figure out if you're being cagey about it, or to try and demonstrate to anybody else who's watching that you're somehow crazy, that you're not somebody who should be listened to because you're irrational. And they do a good job of it. I've heard their arguments echoed, mouthed by even whites, even pro-whites, even people who are aware of the Jews. I've heard use these kind of arguments, these psychopathologizing arguments.
Yeah, monomania is one they like to throw out. You know, it's always this idea of trying to cast people like us as insane, bad, or, you know, losers, which it almost in some way is worse, trying to just almost turn it into a mockery, not even something to be afraid of, but like this silly little sideshow why all the real, you know, respectable people are, you know, hobnobbing with Jews. Those weirdos on the internet, they're criticizing Jews. Don't pay attention to them.
Yeah, or the one that I hear from those people who do talk about the Jews is those guys, the ones with the monomania, talk about the Jews too much. That's the problem. It's too much. And, you know, my understanding of history when I've, you know, examined this problem and the history of the Jews is I would say it's the problem has been the exact opposite throughout history, that Europeans, whites, have not taken the Jews seriously enough historically, have never been talking about the Jews too harshly or too much. Quite the opposite, that we've always been intimidated away from doing so. I mean, going back as far as, I think it was Cicero in the Roman times, keeping his voice down in court, you know, because he didn't want to upset the Jews or something. It's just that's the real problem when you look back in history. It's not that the Jews weren't there doing their thing. They were. What, you know, the failing over and over again amongst white people is thinking that they don't want to overdo it with the Jews. If they just sort of change how their attitude about the Jews is so that they don't think of them so harshly, that maybe they can come to some modus vivendi with the Jews, you know, a way of getting along with the Jews. Can't we all just get along? And I would say that idea itself is coming from the Jews. It serves the Jews. It's this idea that you need to protect the minorities and defend the minorities because you don't want to be a bigot. You don't want to be a hater. That idea comes directly from the Jews. It's the kind of idea that they mouth every day, 24/7, coming out of the organized, their organizations, their Twitter and press release, is like a fire hose of that kind of stuff. And then you get people absorbing that and regurgitating it. The whites who have any sort of power. This diversity is our greatest strength is a good example of one of these mantras that the Jews have created, these catchphrases that they repeated them enough times. And then they got John Kennedy to write a book about diversity is our greatest strength, or we're a nation of immigrants. And then before you knew it, every politician is just anytime there's sort of a non-white shooting, it's like diversity is our greatest strength. Everybody who's got access to a microphone wants to run to it and say diversity is our greatest strength. And we can't let this diminish our hopes for multiculturalism.
Yeah, that is what I think was going on there is what they're trying to do is they're trying to get whites to basically, if white, their ultimate goal is to get whites where they're just mentally not capable of fighting back. But if there is someone with some ability to fight mentally that they can't just beat out of them, can't mentally abuse out of them, they want to redirect it towards whites still. It's kind of the strange thing no one notices. Either way, it ends the same. Whites are to blame. You know, if you're not going to blame whites for white privilege, slavery, and being horrible and racist, well, then they're going to get you to blame whites for the bad things that are happening to white people. It's a strange way of the people that have the instinct to fight trying to redirect that towards whites again.
Yeah, that's a good point, that in the end, it's always the same. It may be a different argument that they use, and they'll shift arguments over time or as one fails, stops working. They'll just go to the next one. But the end is always the same. The end result is always the same. The Jews are not to blame for any of it, and white people are to blame for all of it.
Yeah, and back to kind of pathological altruism. I don't know. I think you've kind of come close to making this point, but in psychology, there are concepts similar of like martyr complex, low self-esteem. I think there even is a term, extreme altruism. What that is, you know, extreme people pleaser, that is a result of emotional and psychological abuse. The kind of people in real life that are actually like that, that go out of their way to do stuff for other people, to please other people, they have low self-esteem because in childhood, they were emotionally abused. So the real world equivalent to pathological altruism, to the extent there is one, is the result of abuse.
Yeah. Yeah. But codependency, I think you're talking about there. These people who basically get joy out of, or at least some sort of sustenance psychologically out of being a doormat for other people, serving other people, which is a healthy thing, I think, for a mother to feel toward her own children, that she sacrifices of herself in order to benefit her children. It's less healthy when a wife does it for a husband. It should be more of a partnership, a give and take, rather than a servile relationship. And it's certainly when it's towards the Jews, it's I would say it's even fake in a lot of cases where, you know, the worship of the Jews is so overt, the praise for the Jewish people. I think about that speech Biden gave to some Jewish organization that came out a couple of years ago, where he credited the Jewish media for being responsible for the gay marriage being accepted and or passed by, you know, the Supreme Court, and other very toxic, degenerate social changes that had happened over the past decades. He was celebrating it, saying how wonderful the Jews were for doing these things, and that they had done it by putting these ideas on television, even when they weren't popular. And, you know, I wonder, is he really so stupid that he thinks he can say those things and that the Jews don't kind of understand what he's trying to do? I don't think that he's trying, for instance, to, you know, he's our guy and he's trying to tip people off that it was the Jews that did these things, but he's just being overly effusive in his praise for the Jews. There was a recent video that I posted on that had a whole bunch of different non-Jews, as far as we know, praising the Jews for their intelligence. It's sort of related to this Kaufness argument about the Jews are just smarter. That's why they have so much power and influence and are overrepresented. But when you see these non-Jews get up and just talk about how wonderful the Jewish people are, you know, they're too smart to not realize that they couldn't be saying this about any other group but the Jews, because they understand political correctness and what political correctness really is, even though oftentimes when the topic of political correctness comes up, they pretend like it's just this weird thing that comes from who knows where and does who knows what. They know exactly what it means. They have to, in order to survive in the environment that they're in. They have to know that political correctness means, above anything else, you do not ever say anything critical of the Jews. And the flip side of that, which is you do not ever say anything in defense of or praiseworthy of whites. That is the true, you know, I didn't make that point earlier when I was talking about white is bad and non-white is good, is when you realize that that's what the morality is, and then you think about, well, where do Jews fall in that? Are Jews white or are they non-white? Well, it's obvious. They're non-white. They are the first and foremost non-white in that schema, that morality that puts non-whites above whites and morally. The Jews have been doing that since before there were any other non-whites among us. They were the only non-whites among Europeans when they first basically created that. They brought it with them, that attitude of the Jew. Some people call it Jew supremacism. This attitude that Jew is good and non-Jew, the Gentile, the Goyim, are just insects, cattle to be manipulated in whatever way we need to you know, for our benefit.
I think in the case of whites, it's a little beyond just manipulate. It's beyond just having disdain. It's actually a particular hatred for us. I think they look at other groups of Gentiles as less than them, but I think that they actually have a unique hatred for us they don't have for Arabs or Asians or blacks.
It's a there is a visceral disgust I detect in, you know, when you read these articles written by Jews about some innocent thing, that some gathering of white people being too white, you know, being, and you look at the way they describe it, and what drives them crazy about white people is just being who we are, just being good looking, talented, capable people, just doing our thing. Drives them insane. And so, yeah, I see that kind of hatred that you're talking about. But part of it is also just a wariness, that, you know, especially ever since, the rise of the National Socialists, it became clear to them that they could not just, play along with these ideas of race. They couldn't just, let things kind of go, that they had to have more, manual control over what was happening and who was allowed to do what. There was a real shift there. Again, Revel Oliver traced the change in the Jewish attitude from pure parasitism and exploitation to extermination, really, of us, slating us for for extinction to World War II. And I agree with that assessment that they were already kind of going in the direction that they ended up going before World War II. That was one of the points I made about Franz Boas, is his anti-racism, his trying to attack the idea that race is a biological reality and in many ways immutable, and very consequential, that, you know, he tried to undermine that before the National Socialists even existed. But it wasn't before anti-Semitism existed. And I think that's the key to understand, is that the roots of the rise of the National Socialists go back, to the 1870s, I would say, at least, or probably earlier than that, the 1848 wars, the 1840s upheaval in Germany, when people in Germany really started to realize that these Jews are aliens and are harming us. And it took almost 100 years for them to finally, basically, for that realization to come to fruition in the form of the National Socialist Party and Hitler. And the Jews have traced all of that back. In the wake of the war, they basically realized what had happened, and they did a post-mortem where they kind of traced back all of the various strains of thought that influenced the National Socialists and led to the rise of the National Socialists had to be extirpated, had to be dug up, turned over, poisoned, burned, eliminated. And if they couldn't outright eliminate it, they would at least salt it and make it so radioactive that nobody would want to touch it. And the rise of the alt-right today, what has me somewhat optimistic about the change over the last 4 or 5 years, and especially the last 2 or 3 years, is that a lot of people are basically shrugging off those radioactive signs that say, no, you're not allowed to think this, Goyim, you're not allowed to touch this. A lot of people are overcoming the taboos, that the Jews have created, the Semitical correctness that says you're not supposed to think those things, you're definitely not supposed to talk about them. People are doing it, and that's why they're having to now resort to more obvious, explicit methods to silence us, to literally delete our accounts and ban us from being able to speak.
And that seems to be backfiring, because at that point you can point to that really as evidence. The censorship, the Jews, they're too neurotic to stop the censorship, but I actually think the censorship is probably one of the things that has accelerated the growth of the alt-right, probably more than anything else.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it was growing quickly even before the censorship began. And the censorship won't hurt it. It's just you won't be able to see it as – it won't be as obvious anymore, because people, instead of being on Twitter, you know, where everyone can see them, they'll be off on Gab, or they'll be in private servers discussing these things, and or on private blogs or whatever. The Jews will come to shut that down too. And in that respect, I'm not all that optimistic that because there is a historic precedent for this too, which is Bolshevik Russia, the rise of the Soviet Union. And one of the first things that they did once they seized power there was they outlawed anti-Semitism, and they made it a capital crime, literally the death penalty for criticizing the Jews. And that lasted for decades, you know, when it 1917 through the late 80s. And even when the Soviet Union supposedly collapsed, the Jews still have maintained a great deal of control over that country. It's maybe not, you know, death penalty for anti-Semitism anymore, but there are laws against Holocaust denial, for instance.
yeah, to this day, in Russia, you have that kind of stuff, which, I mean, I don't want to get into the Putin thing, but, you know, I do bring that up to people when people go full pro-Putin, is it's a country with Holocaust denials, denial laws, and the man has been photographed with rabbis so many fucking times.
Yeah, I think the positive things you might say about Putin are just as, I'm just as skeptical about when people say the positive things about Trump. They are so desperate for some leader, somebody to be on our side, that they fantasize. It's wishful thinking. They see in Trump or in Putin something that isn't really there.
Yeah.
I mean, I try not to be a doomsayer about somebody like Trump or paint it as worse than it really is, but I try to be realistic about it. That, look, this isn't a guy that's just sort of bumbling through the presidency and kind of accidentally doing whatever the Jews tell him to do. And yeah, okay, maybe he drags his feet a little bit, but he's not dragging his feet. When the Jews tell him to jump, generally he jumps. And the few times when he's kind of dragged his feet about it, it isn't because he cares about white people. It's because he doesn't, you know, he bristles. He's got an ego. He doesn't want to be seen as a lapdog, as somebody who just jumps whenever he's told to. And that's why he hesitates. That's why he pushes back sometimes. But, you know, this idea that he's playing 4D chess or whatever, it's become a joke. I mean, at first it was kind of funny in a way, but it's become a sick joke now that it's really anybody who tries to make excuses for what he's doing is helping. They're enabling him to do what he does.
Yeah, I mean, our best bet with Trump, and I've never expected Trump to really accomplish much of anything, but to the extent he could do anything that remotely benefits us, it requires keeping pressure on him and basically, for lack of a better word, bullying him, because, as you said, he's a man with an ego and he wants to be liked. He wants to be thought of as this, you know, great big super president. So I think, you know, there are times where we can maybe get him to do something or not do something, but it requires his supporters actually being willing to turn against him and attack him.
Yeah, that's the bullying. That's a good phrase for it. And that's something that the alt-right or anybody who's basically wanted to believe that Trump would help should be doing, is being critical of him. But because they know that it's so rare that a politician ever says anything that whites want to hear, and that Trump said lots of things that whites wanted to hear, they want him to be the leader. They want him to be the guy that rides in on the white horse and saves the white race. But it would be better. They would have more effect on him if they attacked him, criticized him, mocked him in the same way that the Jews do. I mean, the Jews, partly their influence over Trump is just raw influence. You know, we're going to make your life unpleasant if you don't do what we're telling you to do, the kick lick thing. But part of it is also psychological tricks where, like, for instance, they wanted to get rid of Bannon. They were calling Bannon a Nazi, a neo-Nazi, and all this stupid hysterical stuff. They knew, you know, Bannon was not even a Richard Spencer type, much less a Hitler type. But the way they got under Trump's skin and finally got him to get rid of Bannon was calling him President Bannon. You know, basically mocking Trump for being cucked or being upended by his own underling. And so in the end, they got Trump to fire Bannon, get rid of Bannon, because, or just by playing that psychological trick on him, mocking him for that. And that's the kind of thing that the alt-right people could do if they got together a hashtag thing or, you know, raise their voices enough in unison to mock or ridicule, what's his name? His Jew son-in-law, just mercilessly, you know, mock that guy and the influence that he has over Trump.
Yeah.
President Kushner. You know, the Jewish media will never do it, but that doesn't mean that the alt-right couldn't do it. And I think it would actually have an effect. if the alt-right did it. I don't think that the alt, that he, that Trump pays too much attention to the alt-right or would do things that the alt-right wants him to do. But you could get him to back into doing what you want him to do by, you know, indirectly, by getting at his psychology, by understanding what drives him, that it's not some love for the white race or desire to screw the Jews. He will never do anything that hurts the Jews, not consciously, not intentionally. And just like he'll never consciously do something that helps whites. You know, he doesn't want to be seen as a racist. He doesn't want to be seen as a Nazi. He bends over backwards to try not to be seen in those ways. The reason why he made those promises or those campaign promises and said the things that whites wanted to hear wasn't because he actually wanted to deliver on them necessarily. It was because he knew if he said those things, he would get lots of votes. He'd get more votes than he would lose. So that's why he said them.
Yeah, and basically what he did was he came out and he ran on the most basic common sense platform anyone has seen in decades. And I think, you know, a lot of these people at the top are smart. They know what would be, you know, they know what would be popular. Trump was just the guy for whatever reason that said, you know, I feel like being president today. I'll come out and say the things that everyone knows everyone wants to hear.
Yes. Yeah, basically. He had that kind of, that level of self-confidence that the other politicians, the Bushes and the Cruises, didn't and wouldn't dare. And for a couple of decades now, basically since Nixon's time, the politicians have known what whites wanted to hear, what the majority of the voters, if the system really worked the way that they describe it, the political system, that is, that, you know, whoever gets the most votes wins, then all of these politicians would be saying what white people want to hear, and they would have been doing it all along because they know that's where the majority of the votes are. But they also know what isn't talked about so much and acknowledged openly, which is that the way the system really works is the money and the media dictate who gets selected to begin with to even be eligible to get voted for, and that the ones who are selected generally, at least from Nixon on, have been afraid to say anything that whites want to hear because they realize that the media will then tear them down for being racist. You're not allowed to do that. That came out pretty clearly in the postmortem debate or discussion that the two campaign teams had in the wake of this campaign, in between the election day and the inauguration, sometime in mid-December, I think it was, and I forget the names of the people who were involved, but basically all of Trump's people got together in a conference room with all of the Clinton people, and they argued about what had happened during the election campaign and what went wrong, what went right, you know, accusations back and forth. And the main accusation of the Clinton people was, you weren't supposed to say these things that the racists want to hear. And by racist, they just mean white people, of course. They use the word white and racist sort of interchangeably. It's the same word. It means the same thing. And that is another one of those major features of political correctness. That's the other thing that Trump himself confronted early on when he was not yet the clear leader. It was one of those early debates where there were like nine guys on the stage. And he said that he wanted to political correctness is killing this country or something along those lines. And his ratings then, that's when his popularity amongst white people just skyrocketed, because that's exactly what white people don't like about the way things are. They don't like this political correctness. They may not be able to explain what political correctness is exactly, or they may be afraid to explain it because of political correctness, because they know that there are consequences for objecting to it or even describing what it is. But Trump was willing to challenge it and to name it, and to he also didn't get into the reality that it's basically created by the Jews. It's Jew Sharia, because part of what gave him the courage to say the things, as you said, that he knew had to be said to get the votes that he wanted to get so he could be president, he could say those things because he knew in his mind that he didn't have any bad intentions towards the Jews, that he didn't hate the Jews, that he couldn't be accused of being an anti-Semite. he or a Nazi or Hitler or anything. He was. The Jews did it anyway. The Jews that didn't want him in office, the Jews who think that the time of the white people is over and the time of the orcs has begun, the mainstream of Jews who think that way, who are against him. But he knew that he had worked with Jews his whole life, that he liked the Jews, maybe in a Luke Ford way, that he had intermarried, all his kids were intermarried with the Jews. There are some people who think Trump himself is part Jewish, crypto-Jewish in some way. And, you know, basically I could see that from early on in the campaign, that he was basically just going to be another Reagan-type figure where he would say certain things that sound good to white people, and white people would love him for it, and he loves the Jews, and that the Jews hate him, and the bulk of the Jews anyway, and hate white people, and they hate him mainly because the things he says they know appeal to white people and get white people riled up.
Yeah, one thing I will say kind of in favor of Trump, or at least in his defense, or at least against the idea that it was planned or that he was working with the Jews from the beginning, is he said things that were very dangerous to them. He changed the conversation in such a way that they would not want. It wouldn't be worth the risk to give whites some kind of steam valve. That's why I don't go along with the steam valve idea. I think he pushed the Overton window so far right, I don't think the Jews would be dumb enough to try something like that. So I do think that it was something they would have rather avoided, that it wasn't their plan.
Yeah, I agree. It was not some sort of intentional thing, I don't think. I can see it. I mean, there's a principle of it's not Occam's razor, maybe it is related, but, you know, basically there's no need to imagine it doesn't have to have been a deliberate thing. You can see how this happened kind of by accident, almost, that they really didn't want him to come to power, and they were counting on Hillary to win. But part of what the Jews do, and part of what makes democracy a sham, is they select the candidates ahead of time. I mean, they vigorously vet them, and there's literally a sort of a Jewish primary before the real primary, the supposed real primary begins. There's the real Jewish primary, where they go and they have to kiss the ring of the Sheldon Adelson on the Republican side or the Chaim Saban on the Democrat side, and make sure that they've got the seal of approval of the Jews before they can even run. And the only reason that Trump did win is because he had at least the support of a sizable amount of, you know, sort of critical mass of Jews that were willing to back him, in spite of the fact that the other three quarters or seven eighths of the Jews were screeching their heads off about how he was Hitler.
Yeah, it was interesting. I remember watching the campaign. He would say, you know, very basic stuff, and they would attack him as being a racist, horrible Nazi, and then a handful or even less Jews would come out and say, oh, he's not a Nazi. You know, he doesn't hate the Jews. He doesn't hate black people. He's going to do wonderful, great things for Jews and for black people and et cetera, et cetera.
And he would say those things himself toward the ends of his, eventually. And now during his actual presidency, that's all he does. He's not saying things that white people want to hear anymore. He's basically just, doing things to please the Jews, bombing whoever, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, pardoning, you know, Jews. It's disgusting. But I'm not surprised at all by it. I saw it coming, because I'm older than most of the alt-right types. They're fairly young men, most of them, and they don't have a memory of the betrayal by Reagan. And they don't have a memory of the betrayal by Schwarzenegger and the betrayal by Thatcher and all of these white leaders in the post-war years have basically been traitors, and they've known the score. They have to know the score, as I said, to even get to the level that they're at. They have to please the Jews. They know the Jews are important. There was a recent exposure of some Clinton emails that was discussing, outreach to the Jews that how to get the support of the Jews. And it didn't even go into much detail. It just, the subject of the email was Jews, and then talked about how having the son-in-law being a Jew and wearing his Jewy stuff and having a photo go out on the news wires was more effective than most of the rest of the outreach that they were trying to do to Jews to convince them to, you know, fund them and vote for them. But the truth is that both the parties are basically dancing to the tune that the Jews call. The Jews provide the bulk of the funding for their parties, and they provide either the positive or the negative media. You know, some of the media outlets are pro-Democrat, pro-Democrat party, and then you've got Fox News, which is famously the on the other side, and Breitbart and Drudge. That's what I would call the alt-Jew. You know, it's a false opposition. It's a false, it gives white people the idea that there's a good side and a bad side to choose from. And some of the white people choose the one good side and some choose the other. And it's just classic divide and conquer, really. And Trump, where he broke the mold, I have to agree with you when you point out that he said things that just seemed unthinkable for a politician to say, at least ever since George Lincoln Rockwell was assassinated, because he said that and more, and he was sincere about what he was talking about, and talked about the Jews and the Jews as enemies. But what I would credit Trump with doing, and I think it was only accidentally that he did it as sort of a side effect of his own ambition to become president and his ruthlessness to do that despite what the bulk of Jewry wanted or didn't want, is that he called attention to the media, and he surfaced this reality, which is that most white people don't like the media. There's a thing that Alex Linder says, was saying back on Twitter, I remember distinctly during the campaign. It's like, you know, if you don't like the media and you don't like the way this society is run, you don't like the Jews. You may not know it yet, but you don't like the Jews because they're the ones that you're not liking. It's their behavior. It's their agenda. It's their terminology. It's their way of doing things that you're not liking. And that's a healthy sign, or a sign of healthy instincts, at least, that white people distrust the media, don't like the media. When the media started attacking Trump mercilessly, instead of and coming up with all this dirt and sleaze, which lots of it was true, to try and discredit Trump, white people, instead of discrediting Trump, and this was something that really disturbed the Jews to realize, was that the more dirt that they tried to heap on him, the opposite happened. He gained strength and gained support, and it didn't diminish him. That was an interesting phenomena to see, because it did have that indirect effect of basically everybody realized, hey, that this is almost an emperor's new clothes sort of situation, where the media seemed so powerful in the past. If, you know, that's what kept the Bushes and the Cruises and the so forth from saying anything that white people wanted to hear. And Trump bucked that. And not only did he say the things that the media didn't want him to say, but he actually then pointed his finger at the media and said, see, the media doesn't want to hear this. The media won't show the size of this crowd. You know, that kind of stuff that he was right to do. It's just people, I think white people are too willing to give him credit and mistake his motives, that he was somehow doing that because he wanted to be the leader of white people and do the right thing by right white people. That's not it at all. I think he did it for his own personal ambition, because he wanted to be president that badly.
Yeah, I don't think that there is really any sincere empathy towards whites on his part. I think that there was just a desire to hold the position and a pragmatic understanding of how to get there and the financial means to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, and he had those financial means because he did have powerful Jewish friends. You know, it was maybe a minority compared overall, but they were powerful enough and had enough control over enough media to support him, and so that he could actually get elected. But you see, when a Paul Neelan or I forget the other guy, Arthur Jones, I think. When a politician runs who actually talks about whites versus Jews and talks frankly and directly favorably about whites, that they're attacked even more mercilessly than Trump was. And ultimately white people shy away from them and abandon them and won't support them. You know, because they're just crazy. It's just crazy talking about those things.
Yeah, social shaming is really the most powerful weapon they have. You know, as a species, you know, we're, you know, pack animals, so we have the instinct to want to fit into our group. And I think as white people, you know, being civilized probably the longest of any of the races, the instinct might be stronger in us. So we have that urge to virtue signal, to go along, to get along. And we don't want to be thought of as bad people or crazy people or whatever. And I think this is the reason you see people like Kevin McDonald that can know everything we know, but still want to sugarcoat things because they still have that instinct of, I don't want to be looked at as a bad person or as a crazy person by people that are ultimately your enemies.
No, I don't think he's doing it because he wants to please Jews so much. It's he does it because he wants to be respected and admired by whites. He doesn't want to, you know, offend his own sensibilities, and which are indirectly white sensibilities. But, you know, in that respect, I would say we've been gaslit. We've been misled by the Jewish media about just how far whites actually, what whites would accept, what whites would, you know, really, what whites really want and what they would really tolerate from a leader. And I saw that in the wake of the election of Trump. McDonald gave an interview and he said something like, wow, I never could have imagined that this was going to happen, that he was going to win. And I thought to myself, well, I could imagine. I was imagining from the mid, right after he announced, I thought, yeah, this could work. I could see whites voting this guy into office. I didn't see a problem with him being a clown or a TV star or any of that stuff that would get in the way. He was basically saying the things that whites wanted to hear. This is the way it's supposed to work, right? Not that I thought it would be necessarily good for whites. It was not all that clear to me. I still had not confronted in my own mind the reality that he had been around Jews and had been, you know, partnered with Jews his whole life. But what I took away from that, and that's not really just a criticism of McDonald, it's white leaders in general have this problem where they basically censor themselves or keep themselves, reasonable because they assume that they're going to like scare away white people if they talk too bluntly, too harshly in terms that are too harsh or blunt. Calling the Jews the enemy, for instance, instead of having this tolerant attitude towards the Jews of, well, of course we don't want Jews running our organizations, but if they want to join our organizations and give us a hand, sure, we'd be open to that. That's foolish. You can see why they do it. They think they've actually swallowed this propaganda that if you don't act tolerant, that white people are going to not like you, that white people are going to somehow shun you for being too crazy. And the opposite is true. In fact, I think from the historic examples I can think of are what was called massive resistance when the schools were first integrated from the top down, you know, the Supreme Court and the LBJ. I think that's who it was. Or was it, am I thinking about Eisenhower now? Massive resistance, I'm pretty sure, was in the 60s, so that would have been LBJ. But, you know, there was this groundswell. It was a true grassroots resistance from whites who were, by that point, already mostly leaderless. There were no more politicians in Congress or the Senate or much less in the White House who were explicitly racialist and explicitly pro their own people, like, say, President Wilson was back in the 1920s, even though Woodrow Wilson was, you know, basically a tool of the Jews, he was also racially aware and made no excuses that he was a white man and that he was, you know, favored whites. But sometime between Wilson and Nixon, that went away. And it didn't just go away because and change fundamentally. It didn't go away because white people just sort of changed and fundamentally and decided, hey, this isn't good for us. We're good. We're just going to, you know, open up our doors to everybody and pretend that anybody can be us. It was a deliberate campaign by the Jews to crack open the United States. And in addition to the United States, every other white country in the world was going through this same pressure and transformation. And World War II is when it really came to a head. And then in the wake of World War II, there was the freak out of the 1960s and the corporate freak out in the 1980s. What was that called? The junk bond thing, Michael Milken and Carl Icahn. And, you know, it has happened in spurts, the Jewish takeover and more overt rule by Jews has happened over the course of the last century in fits and spurts and in some places more obvious than in others. But there's no denying, really, you know, maybe we ought to flip this around and make it out that the people who try to deny that the Jews have this incredible power and this incredible hostility towards whites, that they're the ones who are stupid. They're the ones who are crazy. The ones who try to play down the role that the Jews have played and that the Jews are playing now is what's stupid and crazy going forward.
Yeah, I think, you know, that kind of psychology could work. I've suggested in the past, at least in the online sphere, mocking the Holocaust and mocking the idea of believing in the Holocaust. I mean, we can look at this story as absurd. I mean, why wouldn't you just laugh in the face of any person that expects you to believe this happened?
Yeah, that's right. And I think mocking it, ridiculing it, making fun of it is the way to go. And that's the Count Dankula thing in Scotland recently with the dog. It wasn't the Sieg Heiling of the dog that was really the problem from the Jewish point of view. What really got to the Jews was how funny it was that the guy just kept saying, "Gas the Jews? You want to gas the Jews, son?" And that's what was so hilarious about that video. And that was what the video was all about, really, was he had programmed the dog to the point, he had done the reverse of what the Jews have done. He had, you know, made it so that all he had to do was say, "Jews." And the dog would wake up when he could say any other word and the dog wouldn't wake up. But he would snap to attention the minute he said, "Gas the Jews, want to gas the Jews." And that the Jews have done the opposite to us. They've basically given us this Pavlovian reaction through their media propaganda, the relentless taking of their own side and psychopathologizing of anyone against them, that all they have to say is 6 million and gas chambers and 6 million and Holocaust. And white people just immediately start groveling and giving them whatever they want. You know, "Oh, you poor Jews." And how bizarre that is, that they are the most powerful, most wealthy, and most in-your-face ethnic group, tribe on the planet. And people feel, even in the face of that, that they need to defer to them. It's, you know, at least part of that deference is really not because people really feel sorry for the Jews. It's more because they know that they can't ridicule the Jews without harsh penalties. And that's what the Jews were trying to do with the Dankula thing, like they try to do anytime somebody prominent says something critical of the Jews. They smack that person hard because it's not so much that they want to stop that one person from doing what they're doing. They want to send a clear message to everybody else who might be tempted to go along with it, that if you do this kind of thing, this is what's going to happen to you. And that's why they make it a very public thing. They publicize that, "Oh, did you hear this person said this horrible anti-Semitic thing?" And then they draw out the process, the groveling process that the person is expected to go through over the course of several days or even weeks. Mel Gibson is the most famous recent example of that, but it basically happens every couple of months that somebody prominent says, you know, puts their foot in the mouth about the Jews, says something unworshipful about the Jews, and they come down on them like a ton of bricks to send that message. And joking about the Holocaust is serious business. That's, you know, they do not want that to start. And that's what's going on 4chan and Infinichan, on the chans and the back channels of the internet, on Daily Stormer, those kind of, places, people are free still to mock and ridicule the Jews, not just about the Holocaust, but about everything, about their noses, about their fellow white people tricks, about, all of the stuff that they do. And it works. Anglin, has described it very well, the psychology of it, how the humor sort of flies under the radar. This is actually something that the Jews realized a long, long time ago. And that you can, through this mockery, you can tear down the norms and, replace them with the opposites, with the norms that you want. We don't have the same leverage that the Jews have. The Jews have these multi-billion-dollar multinational media companies, and so their message gets broadcast 24/7 around the globe, whatever they want heard. But the power in the counter message to that is that it's true, and that it's long past due that somebody make fun of the Jews and their robotic 6 million, you know, their insistence on using this number. It's like a shit test. If we say 6 million enough, are there any goyim who are going to challenge that number? Like, where did that number come from? Or are they going to realize that we've been using that number like our whole history, and certainly in the decades before the National Socialists even came to power, we were already using that magic number, 6 million. This thing I've stumbled across recently that Michael Hoffman apparently created, this phrase, the revelation of the method, which is, it has to do with basically telling, your victims what you're doing to them. And in that, you do it subtly, of course, but by doing that, it's like a magic spell it gives you the moral authority then to basically do what you want with them. Because after all, you know, it's sort of like when you sign a contract. Well, you know, you signed this contract, you know, or in this case, it's, you know, you heard me describe what I was going to do, and now I'm doing it, so you can't object. You know, and that plays into this argument that I'm having now, and it's a recurring argument that, well, you know, white people let this happen, so you really can't blame the Jews. The Jews have been pretty blatant about what they're doing, and it's happened over and over and over again. And why, you know, when it's happened so many times, you can't really blame the Jews anymore. You have to blame white people for not doing something about it. And I see why that works, that argument, why that appeals to some people, and why they even make it themselves and try to convince other people of that. It doesn't work on me so much, because I can see so many reasons why I still wouldn't blame white people for that. The number one thing being, I'm white. Why would I blame my own people for anything they do? Unless it was like outright suicidal. And that doesn't happen. I mean, organisms don't just kill themselves. They are, they go extinct, but that extinction happens due to competition with other forms of life. And white men were beginning to figure that out, the science of that. They were beginning to see that, hey, we're just animals. They had set aside the Jew fantasies and myths of the Bible in the mid-1800s. They were really starting to leave that shit behind and become more realistic in their thinking, more science and evidence-based. and we're beginning to figure out that, hey, this animal husbandry stuff cultivation and these things that we've been doing with plants and animals for the last several centuries, the last several millennia, that applies to human beings too. And the differences that we see amongst the breeds of animals that we raise for livestock, there are also breeds of men. And those differences, I mean, Western white men have been aware of those kind of racial differences forever. As far back as the Greeks were aware of race, and they didn't talk about it in the same terms that we do today or the National Socialists did in the 1930s, but they understood it without knowing about DNA, without knowing about blood types. They could see just on the surface, and they could see the behavior of people too was different in the different families, the different clans. This is something that Arthur de Gobineau wrote about in his Inequality of Human Races. He was actually making the point and talking mainly, primarily about the white race and the sub-races of the white race, the various races within whites, and how these differences would tend to give an advantage to one group, which would rise to power in a given area. It was sort of like the Peter principle of race, that they would, because of their competency, because of this new innovation and their way of doing things that was better than the ones around them, they would come into more power and control. But as they would expand and their power would grow and beyond a certain critical size, they would become an empire. Their control would extend beyond their own relatively homogenous group, and it would extend to include other alien races of people, and then they would start to mix with them, and then it would all be undone, because what de Gobineau called degeneracy was, by definition, race mixing, is what he considered the root of degeneracy. And there was a lot of power, and this is one of in that explanation, there was a lot of explanatory power to de Gobineau's thesis, his view. And it wasn't a very scientific thesis. He kind of laid out the argument in plain English. It was actually kind of flowery English, I thought. It's actually wrote in French, but the translation, the floweriness of the French came through. And de Gobineau is one of the primary roots that the Jews traced back in the wake of World War II and said, aha, this guy, we got to make sure nobody reads this guy or pays attention to what he was saying ever again. And you can pick that up whenever you do see him mentioned. The rare times, it's always with this venom and scorn attached. Oh, de Gobineau had this theory about race. But it's well worth a read. It's shorter, and he doesn't talk about the Jews, but it's basically in a compact form. It's well worth reading. I would recommend that to read even before you read something like Culture of Critique or the rest of the trilogy of McDonald's.
Yeah, it's on my list of things to read. I know that it was very influential. The other things I've read on race were race, evolution, and behavior, which the RK selection is something I think really explains what happens when a superior group kind of comes in contact with an inferior group. The inferior group usually has a higher fertility rate, so it automatically puts them at an advantage, even though they're technologically inferior.
Yeah, historically, I think that's what the ancient genetic evidence is showing, that ultimately the people with the higher reproductive rate or prevail ultimately, at least from a genetic point of view, long after the fact. Who knows what kind of intrigues happened in the past? I would assume it's similar to what's going on today, that there are whole groups of people who have been basically tricked in some way to not reproduce. It's maybe worse today than it could have been in the past because of the technology that makes it possible. Mass media makes it possible now to literally broadcast a message to worldwide with your toxic, poisonous message that says, oh, homosexuality is good, and trans, cut your genitals off, that's a good thing, that makes you a good person. look at Bruce Jenner. He's such a hero, isn't he? That couldn't have been done in the past to the extent it's done today, but I'm sure that similar things were done. But what, you know, that brings up something we were talking about just before we got on, went live here, which is this, the recent developments in science that, continue to expose. I mean, it was always there. What the race scientists were exposing 100 years ago, 150 years ago, was the reality of race and racial differences amongst men. And it was basically suppressed in the wake of World War II, and it's bubbling up again because it's real, because it's there, and the people continue to work on the race-related sciences, the biology and genetics especially. But psychology also touches on it to a certain extent. And, you know, what's happening is for the last 100 years or so, the Jewish anti-racist paradigm, the Jewish anti-racist narrative that, which today has culminated in this whites are bad, non-whites are good morality. It's sort of the end of the line, the end result of this quote unquote anti-racist line of thinking. That has dominated for 100 years or so since Boas's day, and especially after World War II. And it's been based on lies. It's been based on big lies. The big lie being that race doesn't exist. The fallback lie after that is that race doesn't matter, even if it does exist. The fallback lie after that, that, well, there's no harm that comes from the differences. The fallback after that is, well, if there is harm, it's white people harming non-whites. You know, inverting the direction of it. And then the final thing, which we're grappling with even today, when once you punch through all of those other excuses, not to blame the Jews, not to fight the Jews, not to, you know, think in terms of race and what's good for your own group, the final thought and the final obstacle is, no, you can't blame the Jews because you should blame yourself because you haven't done anything to resist the Jews after all this time. And it's sort of that, you know, the beginning of the argument doesn't line up. It's, in fact, it's a direct contradiction of the end of the line argument that the same people make in a string there. The Jews, you know, first deny that there is any such thing as race. And by the time you get to the end, it's like, ha ha, we won, we replaced you.
Yeah, they, it seems like what they're doing is they're shifting slowly. I think in 5-6 years, there won't be any Jews arguing that race doesn't exist.
Well, they're already not arguing that race doesn't exist, really. I mean, that's what's funny about the, not funny, but kind of bizarre about the term anti-racism is because, the white people at least interpret that as meaning you shouldn't be judging people based on their race, just in a sort of objective fashion without any consideration as to what race you're talking about. Whereas the anti-racists, the people who self-identify as anti-racist, they're almost to a man anti-white. That's what they mean by anti-racist. Racist just means white in their mind. The racism is what white people do. And they're more or less honest about that. That's, you know, you can find examples of them that say, yeah, that's pretty much it. And, but most of them are still kind of in denial about it or hiding it, to one degree or another. But that's becoming more overt. And so another way of describing it is sort of this transition over the last 100 years that I've talked about, from Wilson to, you know, Trump today, is from a white supremacist, an unapologetically white supremacist system of government that put whites on top, put whites first. Whites were first-class citizens, and non-whites were not treated as first-class citizens. They weren't brutalized, and they could easily have just stayed out of America or gone back to Africa or whatever at that point in the 1920s. But it's transitioned over the last 100 years to what is really a non-white supremacist regime. It's an inversion basically of what was in the past, and it's more, again, it's some of them are more honest about admitting it than others. There's this awkward in-between state that the liberals basically helped give birth to this idea of, well, we're all together in a society and we share it and we should all be treated equally. The society shouldn't be organized for any one group. We're all equal. All of those ideas are kind of mixed together in the middle, the transition to, you know, from the white supremacist, or, you know, basically whites are in charge of their own destinies, to this system or the zeitgeist today, which is increasingly heading towards whites exist to serve non-whites, and first and foremost, the Jews. And we only exist to the extent they want us to exist. We will be, we're being put out to pasture. That's the ultimate plan. It's just, going to take a few more decades.
Well, these Jews are so vindictive, you know, they also want to torture us a bit on the way out.
Well, yeah, especially anyone who shows any resistance.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've noticed that there was when I first moved to North Carolina, I was doing a lot of traveling locally and getting to know some of the towns and the cities in my area. I'm in the mountains of North Carolina. Very nice up here. But down in the middle of the state, more towards the middle of the state, is Winston, Salem, and Greensboro. And I, at that point, going to Greensboro, I was like, oh, this has some history. There's the blacks during the civil rights thing had at a Woolworth's diner, they staged some sort of protest where they came in and sat in a whites only restaurant, and they wouldn't leave until they were served. And that happened at some point in the late 60s, I think, or mid 60s. And then later on, there was the Greensboro Massacre that was, I think, in the 70s sometime. And now a days in Greensboro and Winston, both of those cities have not just blacks, but colonies from every corner of the globe, Southeast Asians and South Asians and East Asians and Africans from Africa, directly from Africa, and, you know, just Mexicans, of course. And it's almost deliberate. You know, it's like those communities tried to resist, and they're being taught a lesson now. And the Jews have these, are famous for this, or infamous for it, this, Amalek attitude towards their enemies, where they don't just want to defeat their enemies, they want to utterly destroy and exterminate their enemies, and then erase their name from history, you know, erase them from history. I don't think that I'm imagining this association, this lesson that the Winston-Salem and Greensboro areas are being subjected to, but except to say that it's happening everywhere too, even in places that didn't have a history of resisting. It just seems to me that they prioritized the places that did resist to get the very first waves of diversity enrichment. And nowadays, of course, they're going to the whitest places they can find in America and deliberately putting, whole towns from the other side of the globe, planting them in the middle of an otherwise peaceful and calm, beautiful, white community.
Yeah. And it's the worst of the worst too. Like, I was in Minnesota last week this last week for a medical appointment. It was freakish. I was there last year. It was the same thing. You have all these friendly white people, these beautiful blonde women, and you see these Somalians wearing freaking burqas walking around, and it's bizarre that it's not just like mestizos or American blacks. They take the best stock of white people they can find in this country, and they put the worst of the worst third world right next to them.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. When you look at it objectively, it's bizarre. that's exactly what it is. It's like, how is this happening? And that is exactly where you have to basically put it in context. It's like white flight. I remember, when I first started to look into white flight and what had been written about it and how people talked about it and described it. And of course, anything in the Jewish media is negative. White flight is something bad and wrong and evil that white people do. The reality is that whites were doing what they could do. They were trying to get away. They had already lost control of their own government. Their own government representatives were basically going along with the forced integration and desegregation, forced disintegration, as Linder would point out it is. And they were left with only one thing that they could do, which is try to get away from it. They still had the freedom to pick up and move someplace else. And that's white flight in a nutshell. But basically, white flight, rather than being an indication that whites were somehow pathological or psychopathological, that there was something wrong with them mentally, or morally, it was actually an indication. It is actually an indication that something wrong was being done to whites, that any other group that was being, that you could notice some trend that they were picking up and leaving someplace and that they were complaining about why they were leaving and maybe even being dishonest about why they were leaving, they would be sympathized with, you know, they would be objects of sympathy. They're just looking for a better life for themselves and their family, and they're being mistreated and oppressed wherever they are. But it's because of this constant 24/7 propaganda against whites that is where this anti-white morality comes from. This idea that whites are just wrong and evil and everything we do is wrong and evil. It comes from this constant drumbeat from the media, the constant propaganda. And it's, of course, it's not just in the newspapers or the televisions. It's in the schools now too. And the Holocaust propaganda, is a big part of that. It's, you could say it's the keystone of it, that it's, that is sort of the hallmark that the Jews have gotten control, total control over your educational system when they're able to basically put in a whole new course of study specifically about them and their version of history, where they get to tell you how evil you are. It's bizarre. Again, if you were just to look at it objectively, you were a Martian who had just landed on Earth and you saw that this one group of people was going to schools where they were being taught how evil they are by another group of people, you would say, how does this happen? And this is where there was a comment that somebody made on my site years ago that has stuck with me over time about a biologist. I can't find it now. I'm not going to search, but I'll paraphrase it. A biologist said at one point that when other biologists see an organism in nature behaving in such a way that they're like not doing what's in their own interest, and they're instead serving the interest of some other organism, they just assume that that other organism must somehow be subtly controlling the organism that's behaving in a strange way, or that the organism that's behaving in a strange way is somehow doing something subtly selfish. And I think that fits exactly with what we're seeing, say, for instance, with the traitors that are at the tops of our political systems that are opening our borders to these aliens. It's not that they are stupid. It's not that they're broken in some way that they can't think, that they don't know what they're doing. They know what they're doing. They're doing it for their own benefit. They're doing it because they value their own interests more than they value the interests of their group. So, you know, I hope I made that connection clearly enough that, you know, when you see white people doing these things that seem bizarre, it's pretty obvious that this wouldn't be happening if there wasn't this propaganda that was promoting them doing it and making excuses for it, that this is the right way to behave. This is the right thing to do. You need to celebrate diversity. And that's why the Jews actually flip it and make it so blatant, the way they flip it. You know, the diversity isn't just something to be sort of grudgingly tolerated. It's something to be celebrated. It's something that you want to further in advance. And it's only when you think more critically about it and think more skeptically about it. So what is diversity? What is this thing I'm supposed to be celebrating exactly? And it just means less white people. More diversity means less white people. That's what it really means. And once you realize that, you've got, there's only two reasons why you would continue to go along with it. One is, you think that you can't possibly not go along with it because you'll be punished if you try not to go along with it. And the other, I guess, is that you really believe that it's true, that things will be better with less white people. And there are, I have to say, I think that there are people who aren't Jews, aren't part Jews, they're really just white people, and they really have bought into this argument that, hey, things are going to be better when there's less white people around or no white people around. Then we won't have racism anymore. They believe it. And why do they believe it? Because they trust, and this is where, you know, being civilized, being herd animals, which is all that means, you know, we're domesticated. Civilization is domestication. We want to belong to the, and what we see going on around us, what we hear on the television or what we see on the internet, shapes what we think is good and right. And so when we hear constantly from the media that, hey, it's going to be great. Once white people are a minority, it's going to be better. And once white people are gone entirely, it's going to be like heaven on earth. It's not a surprise that a certain fraction of even white people buy into that and think, yeah, hey, I can see that. I mean, you got all these very powerful, very smart people saying this. Diversity is our greatest strength. Diversity is our greatest strength. The repetition of it and the people repeating it, the celebrities and the luminaries that they get to say that. That explains why so much of what's happening is happening.
Right. It's the instinct to follow leaders. It's the instinct to go along with what figures of authority are saying and not be viewed as outcast or broken. That's a big part of it. I think part of it too is, I don't know what would be a good word to describe it, predictive programming. You know, when they put out these things that say everyone will be mixed race in like 100 years, I don't think that's an accurate prediction. I think that's the Jews jabbing at white people to say there's nothing you can do. I've always maintained if white people knew they could win, I think more of them would stand up than even pro-whites would believe. I think if you could show white people tomorrow that we could have our own country if we just stood up, I'd say 3/4 of white people would be ready to do.
Yeah, of course. There's a sort of stampede effect, even amongst the herd animals. And the problem is, of course, stampeding can be used even by the enemy. And by the Jews have used their own consciousness and our lack of consciousness to stampede us where they want us to be stampeded. And the most famous example I can think of is stampeding white soldiers, white American soldiers into World War I, into Europe, because that's what they, did the Balfour Declaration that they gave in exchange to Balfour, in exchange for the promise that Britain would support, Zionism and, Palestine for the Israelis, for the Jews, was to deliver the Americans into the war.
Yeah.
The predictive programming comes up associated with this revelation of the method. You can call it chutzpah or chutzpathy, that they just seem to have this urge to this irrepressible urge to basically rub it in our faces, some of them. But it also goes hand in hand with them doing the opposite, which is skulking and hiding and disguising what they're doing and denying what they're doing. The two go together. They're complementary in a weird way. And this is something that the Jews they'll often complain that they're accused of being capitalists and communists at the same time, and also of, you know, being the most extreme whatevers, and then also the opposition to that. And it's like they present that argument as if, you know, people making these criticisms of Jews are crazy to blame Jews for everything, you know. And what's really going on, the more subtle point there that they're trying to basically, you know, get your eyes to glaze over and not notice, is that the Jews are playing all sides of every issue so that they guarantee that they're going to win no matter what the outcome, no matter what prevails in the end, no matter what side prevails, is they're on it.
Yeah, and it limits the discussion. They push the Overton window over to the direction they want. They have the quote-unquote left that is militantly anti-white, and then they have the soft, you know, the kosher right, which is less militantly anti-white and more is worried about free market capitalism and market whatever kind of stupid bullshit conservatives even think about these days, so-called conservatives. It's a way of making sure there is no real opposition, and again, kind of making it feel hopeless because, you know, if you see a powerful enemy and the only resistance you see is weak, that's going to break your will to fight.
Yeah, and that's kind of the point I've made about this this argument that people make that, you know, after putting up with the Jews and their shenanigans for the last several hundred, if not several millennia, several hundred years or millennia, that the problem has to be white people, you know, because we just haven't exterminated them yet. The problem with that argument, even if it were true, is it's not very adaptive. It's not very inspiring. In fact, it's the opposite. It's demoralizing. It's basically saying there's no hope because we're just born to lose. We're born to be their slaves. And my race isn't worth fighting for because they won't fight for themselves. And, I see, you know, I think I'm fairly honest with myself and what I write about and what I say about it, that I try to confront the reality. In fact, I'm arguing with people to point out that this has been going on for a long time and that the problem is far deeper than most people realize. That, I think, is what needs to be done, is to let people know that this is not some temporary or recent thing. It's not something that can be overcome by just getting some Jews to see the light and join our organizations, or treat them nicer and then they'll let us have our countries. That it's a much deeper, much longer term problem than that. That's what I actually spend a lot more energy and effort in arguing. But it's just occasionally I come into, I encounter these people who are, I don't know how sincere they are. I don't know if they're just trolling or what, but they want to, buy and sell this, internalized this Jewish argument, which is the Jews argue right from the get-go that it's all white people's fault. So how you get there, as you made that point early on in our conversation here, that they argue in lots of different ways, but the end result is always the same. The conclusion is white people are to blame and Jews aren't. And I've pointed that out. People, I guess, maybe they think I'm trying to play word games or something, but it's a valid point. It's like, you're basically just arguing what the Jews argue, which is the problem is white people. And I don't like that argument. The problem, yeah, that's not to say that white people aren't doing anything wrong and that there's nothing we shouldn't change. The number one thing we should change is not give in to this psychological trick of that they used to constantly get us to point our guns at ourselves, to think that we are the main enemy, that we have to destroy ourselves in order to prevail. It's a nonsensical argument when you kind of take it apart and see what the actual dynamics of it are. And the Jews kind of intimidate. I've noticed a lot this thread that they talk about us and them, and they talk about the other in when they're writing. And when they do that, they're always psychopathologizing it. The idea that there's an us and a them, that you're going to scapegoat the other group, and you know, evil leaders like Hitler knew that that was the secret to gaining power, that all you have to do is scapegoat some other group of people, and that's a very powerful thing, and they're right. That is very powerful. It gives a group a cohesiveness. It gives them an enemy with to which to direct their attacks, their hostility, rather than to themselves. And the Jews know the flip side of that, which is if you can convince your enemy that they are their own enemy, that there is no other enemy, they just have themselves to fight. Well, then they'll act like what's that crab bucket metaphor? They'll just tear themselves apart, limb from limb. The Jews know very well how group identity and group dynamics and all of that stuff, they are highly attuned to that. That's part of their own hypersensitivity to their own interests and you know, who's a Jew, who isn't a Jew, who's making the better argument, what's best for the Jews or what's bad for the Jews, or all of that stuff is not just pointed inward. They also use it as a tool. They know exactly what to do to their enemies to make sure that their enemies don't ever do the right things, aren't allowed to do the right things. And if they try to do the right things, that there's some Jew in there throwing a spanner in the works to make sure that it gets derailed and fails. Not that all failures are due to enemy action, but a lot of it is. And especially when you have an enemy that's, you know, pretending to be you and gets away with it a lot of the time. There's probably more of that. It's probably an underestimated problem. The division and failures that are caused by Jew infiltration.
Yeah, and you know, one argument that they love to raise is how it sounds like it makes you sound weak or it makes you sound pathetic to blame this other group, and it's victimhood and, you know, victim mentality. Yeah. The thing they don't ever, you know, these alt-Jews, they make that argument. What they don't, and the big one they like to compare you to is blacks, but they don't realize is the blacks learn that from Jews. And the reason Jews use that is because it works. Seeing yourself as a victim is an effective strategy. There is something psychological that happens that gives you permission to act when you tell yourself you are the victim. A victim narrative is a very good thing for a group. Jews, that is their main thing, is that they teach themselves, they teach their children that they are the ultimate victims. And this gives them permission to act the way they act. It's not totally taught, it's more genetic. But I mean, if you go all the way back in history to the Old Testament, these people, they're crying about being victims as they're slaughtering children.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's a great point that they're, in biological terms, it's adaptive. They have a belief, however diluted it is, it's not a delusion in a bad way. It doesn't have a bad, I guess it could, that if they push the victim button too hard, that they could wear out the host's tolerance and it could lead to a backlash, and they're constantly worried about that. But it doesn't ever really seem to happen, and it's kind of built into the fact that they're constantly crying about being victims. It's not just white people, but I think, you know, it's kind of a human tendency. Maybe whites are more vulnerable to it relative to other races, other groups. But by crying victim, it has two effects. Like you say, it gives them the license to do the things that they do, the depredations and the ripoffs and the fraud that they commit against others. Because after all, they're just getting retribution for being oppressed by the other. But it also tends to soften us up to their plight, you know, by somehow taking them even partially at face value. You start to sympathize with them. You think, oh, well, they have been oppressed for their whole history, and that's why they didn't like Hitler so much. And it's like, no, they were acting like this before the rise of the National Socialists. It's the rise of the National Socialists have caused them to, you know, basically accelerate and change their plans, but they were already hostile and saw themselves and their destiny as separate from us, the rest of us, long ago, you know, back into antiquity. They're already famous for that.
Well, I mean, it's literally written in their quote-unquote holy book. I mean, these people's view of the end of the world is literally global conquest, the subjugation of all Gentiles, and the extermination of all nations in the old sense meaning ethnicities. that ever crossed him. I mean, no other group of people is this psychopathic, that their vision and their religion is literally like something out of a comic book, global genocide and world conquest.
Yeah, and their holidays are all about basically celebrating the genocide, the extermination of their enemies. Purim is the most famous. You know, they celebrate Queen Esther, who basically pretended not to be a Jew and married the king and then manipulated the king for his men to fight another group of non-Jews, and the two groups of non-Jews basically killed them each other, and the Jews came out on top. And that's their holiday of Purim. It's, yeah. And then at the same time, I mean, they'll talk about something like that, and then they'll go straight into lecturing people about the evils of white supremacy and, the evil Nazis, who, you know, if we have a failing, it's in not taking them seriously enough, not being harsh enough, you know, underestimating them, misunderstanding and underestimating is the real problem. And it's not that much of a mystery why, because you see them do the 1-2 punch in many different ways. There was a video, I think it was the same video I mentioned earlier in our discussion, that was kind of a compilation of Jews saying outrageous things. No, it was a different one. Anyway, it's in that recent Random Bits post that I made. So it was in a comment, I think, Fred posted. And I posted a link to it, so you should be able to find my comment about it. But it was this Jew in some organized Jew, top Jew, was talking about how, you know, their two top priorities. Priority number one was, we got to have the borders open in the United States. We got to have more refugees. We got to have more invaders, you know, more non-whites in this country. And then priority number two, we got to do the exact opposite with Israel. And it was just, I mean, there was no hesitation. There was no smirk. There was no like self-consciousness of his just, and I wouldn't call it a double standard. It was just like pure Jewing. Just point one is Jewing and point two is Jewing. And there's no contradiction between those two things. It's what's best for the Jews. It's what this Jew and all his organization and all the Jews who belong to it think is best for the Jews, is that they crack open the borders of the United States and that they build walls and deport non-Jews from Israel. It's not a big mystery. It's just that white people have been lectured for decades now that that's evil if white people do it. That's why there is a bit of cognitive dissonance with the idea that the lie that Jews are white, right? Because some white people say, oh, Jews are white. Well, they're not allowed to do these things. White people aren't allowed to do these things. And that's where the Jews come back at that point, they play the card, we're Jews. We're not white. We're Jews. We suffered the Holocaust. The white people are the evil people who put us through the Holocaust. And that's why we need a country of our own to be able to do these things in. So they just, they'll say both, you know, things that appear contradictory to whites, but aren't. You're just not thinking Jewily enough. You're not thinking far enough in your own. If you wanted to try and understand what the Jews are doing, just think flat out, what's the best possible thing that I could think for white people? And let's just do it. Even if it means telling, you know, saying apparently contradictory things one right after the other to the same microphone. That's their chutzpah. That's their advantage. That's an adaptive thing that they do that helps them and hurts us. And they're not ashamed of it. They do it blatantly. They do it. There are some that can watch that and they'll say, oh, this doesn't look good for the goyim. They call that a shanda for the goyim. It's a related concept anyway. When a Jew does something embarrassing, that exposes the Jewing a little bit too blatantly, And then the Jews, a flock of Jews will start screeching about how, oh no, this is a Shonda. This is a Shonda. And what they mean is, you know, bury it. We gotta, if we start screeching about what victims we are, and this is the victim narrative, the other use of it is the Jews have been exposed for doing something harmful to the Goyim. Let's just screech as if we're the real victims or will shortly be the real victims. And that will take, you know, basically the air out of the Goyim's mind that they are the victims, and we'll instead replace it with the idea that we're the real victims here.
Well, yeah, I mean, noticing the Jews is, you know, the greatest crime in our culture. Criticizing Jews, I mean, whenever a Jew gets caught doing something, what they'll do is if they can't ignore it, they'll criticize them blatantly as like a white man, like with all this sexual harassment stuff that came out. There was one article written by Jews that acknowledged the one guy, his name escapes me, was Jewish. All the others, they were like, oh, white men or just men in general do this because of power. It was an attempt to totally sidestep the fact this guy and all of them have been really stereotypical Jews.
Yeah. Well, I'm seeing a good sign. I'm not active in posting on Twitter, but I've noticed over the last year while I was lurking there with my read-only account following the news, this phenomena of the fellow white, you know, you can just go in the search engine for Twitter and search for the phrase fellow white. And what people were doing was they find some tweet where a Jew was basically using that term literally to pose as white in order to say something shitty about whites, or in order to give whites some toxic piece of advice. Like, we need to treat people of color better, fellow white people. And then people would, the alt-right people who were doing this would go and find, they would look up that same account for certain Jewish keywords where the person basically admits they're actually a Jew. And I've got a folder full of probably hundreds of examples for this. It's kind of related to the mask wearing that they do. I remember years ago basically arguing with people that Jews aren't white, that they just pretend to be white for the advantage that it gives them in a particular circumstance, but they abandon it as soon as it's no longer an advantage or something. The conversation about white privilege illustrates that. But it was a struggle. There were lots of people who, even though they were racialists, even though they were anti-Jewish, they thought this whole idea about that arguing Jews aren't white is just crazy. Because they're obviously white, you know, they look white. And it's the Jared Taylor level of sophistry that, well, they look white and everybody else thinks they're white. So it would be crazy to try and argue that they're not white. Well, the good news is that now, years later, I'm seeing armies of trolls going out and giving these Jews who are trying to pretend to be white shit on Twitter. It's one of the reasons why Twitter is so actively banning people is because of that confrontation, because people are recognizing that, and it's not just in the fellow white instances, it's whenever some Jew, some media Jew goes on Twitter and says something nasty about whites and then tries to pretend like, hey, I'm not being anti-white, after all, I'm white. They're challenged by these people on Twitter, and that's exactly what gets them banned, is when they go and they make a little bit too much trouble for these Jews who are pretending to be white. And there's a lot more. I would say the tide has turned already, that at least anyone who is part of the alt-right already knows this, that Jews aren't white, that they're hostile to whites, that they see themselves as separate from whites and as different from whites. And it's only fair. It's what whites need to do to survive is to reciprocate that at the very least. And it's the dividing line between the people who call themselves alt-right and the people who are called alt-light or just conservatives or cuck-servatives, is that those kind of people won't even confront the reality of the Jews and the number one reality of the Jews, which is that they're hostile to whites, that they're not actually white. That's where the dividing line is. And it's heartening to me, because that's a step in the right direction rather than the wrong direction. It's people waking up to this trick that's been played that has enabled the Jews to do a lot of what they do.
Yeah, and they've run with it at different angles. I mean, the main one is, you know, Jews are white that they try to play. And then it was, I can't remember his name, but it was a Sephardic Jew that wrote the book 13th Tribe that tried to argue that Ashkenazi Jews were Khazars. Shlomo Sand,
yeah.
Wrote that book, Invention of the Jewish People, that tried to argue Jews just, it was a universalist religion and that they all descend from converts. So they've tried to obscure, you know, who they are and the fact that they are a unique genetic group for a long time. The alt-right, the alt-Jews that are trying to push in, it seems like they're not doing that, or some of them are, but most of them seem to go and accept that Jews aren't white per se. You know, they'll admit the Middle Eastern admixture. So that's good. Thing I've noticed that they're really pushing is the IQ thing, this 115 IQ, and trying to use this. They do this weird little argument where they'll say IQ debunks the JQ because it explains Jewish overrepresentation. And the thing that people don't notice that they're doing is they're intentionally confusing the issue of Jewish overrepresentation with the actual issue, which is Jewish influence.
And Jewish hostility.
And Jewish hostility, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It's not the Jewish question anyway. It's the Jewish problem. And it's a problem because the Jews are hostile, because they're not white. And that's the double talk, the double think that Koffness's whole argument hinges on, is this idea that Jews are white and Jews can be pro-white. And it's really just evil whites who think bad things about Jews that are the real problem. And then furthermore, the argument that, well, Jews are only overrepresented because we're so smart. We're, you know, he's basically admitting that Jews are not white. They're their own separate group. And, you know, that's pretty clear anyway. I mean, it's a level of sophistry that, only people who want to fall for it, fall for it. I saw some of this kind of phenomena with the counter jihad, people it's almost no longer in existence, or at least, you know, it's no longer registers on my, news feed anymore. But for a long time, there was, it was mainly, I guess, in the wake of the Iraq war, just before the Iraq war, the invasion of Iraq, and in the wake of it, that a lot of attention was focused on Muslims. The Muslims are the problem. We've got to, you know, all these Muslims come to the United States, they're flooding into Europe, and there's still people that try to restrict their attention to the Muslims. But never mind. It's not important. As I said, that's falling away now. It's really only people who wanted to believe that it was really the Muslims that stuck with that for any length of time. And for a long time, I argued with people about it. I tried to convince them, as I realized myself, no, the real problem is the Jews, not the Muslims. It's not that the Muslims are not a problem. It's that the Muslims wouldn't be a problem in our countries if it weren't for the Jews who had opened the gates to, you know, before there was a Islamification problem, there was a Judaization problem, is the way I finally boiled it down toward the end. But what and even beyond that, I just basically realized, look, anyone who has got two brain cells to rub together will figure this out eventually. And because I saw other people that basically were figuring it out as well and were no longer deluded by that. But I also saw that there were plenty of people that were sticking with it, and they had a reason to stick with it, because they were Jews or part Jews or married to Jews or for some other bizarre reason had a favorable, a more favorable attitude towards Jews than they had towards whites or Europeans. Usually it turned out to be some sort of, Jewish, literally Jewish, mix, in there. And that ultimately is kind of the conclusion I'm coming to about this suicide meme thing. I mean, for years, after the counter jihad experience, I went into, I was paying attention to this guy, Lawrence Oster, who was talking about the Jews, but he was making excuses and apologies for the Jews and blaming whites, as I came to realize. And that's when he was the one who basically triggered me to realize that this suicide meme thing was like the next fallback. Once you basically lose the argument that it's not the Jews, that the Jews don't matter, and you say, okay, yeah, the Jews are up to all this stuff. Well, no, the last fallback is, yeah, but it's, they only are able to do it because you let them. And that's basically what I call the suicide meme. This blaming whites for killing ourselves specifically to excuse the Jews for any action or activity or role in it. And Lawrence Oster was the first one I saw do that. And I've seen people do it, you know, many, many other examples since then, but I've come to terms with it more recently that basically it's only people who want to believe that for some bad reason will believe it for any length of time. That, and I don't have to be the only one arguing against it anyway, that the arguments that I've made in the past have filtered out there, or people have stumbled upon them themselves, come upon them, because it's not exactly rocket science to figure out what the problem is with these arguments. And they argue against them themselves. And I'm happy to see that. And I think ultimately, if what I believe is true anyway, that whites aren't born to lose, that I don't have to be overly concerned and make that my mission in life to fight the suicide meme. It will be fought by itself by the people who aren't suicidal. It's, the point I've made before is, if it were suicide, there would be no argument. Nobody would be arguing about the suicide meme. They wouldn't have to argue that it is suicide, and nobody would be arguing against it, because it would just be something that we do because we want to do it, which is what suicide is. If you want to kill yourself, you go and you kill yourself, and there's no arguing about it.
Still there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Was I not coming through there at the end?
There was kind of an, it kind of broke up for a second. You were saying you go and you, if you want to kill yourself, you go and kill yourself.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, it is, people do struggle with that, struggle with, you know, to be or not to be. But then they ultimately decide to do it if that's what they want to do. But that's sort of the argument that I've made about, against the suicide meme, is it's obviously not what many, many white people want. And it's been done, the things that are identified as suicidal that people like to talk about and point to and say, oh, look, whites must be suicidal to be letting this happen. The things that they point to about that is they were done against popular opinion. Immigration is the number one example of that. That was not done by popular demand. That was done against what the masses wanted. And if you want to say that whites are have failed in some way, it's that we've failed to assassinate leaders that betray us in that way, and assassinate or just outright kill or chase off any aliens that try to impose themselves upon us. That's our failing, and that's exactly the kind of brutal talk that the kind of people who talk about pathological altruism don't want to hear and don't want to talk about themselves. So they have no real standing to complain about suicide or pathological altruism, because the minute you stand up and you say, okay, let's do something about this, they go, oh, no, we can't have any violence, can't do that. Those personalities, those attitudes tend to go hand in hand. You know, oh, whites are to blame for this because we haven't done anything. And then you say, okay, let's do something about it. Oh, no, can't do anything about it.
It also goes hand in hand with tone policing. I've noticed that a lot of the people that don't want people to focus too much on the Jews also were the ones to nag about, you know, oh, we shouldn't use mean words, or we shouldn't use naughty symbols.
Yeah. Yeah. They've got, things that they want other people to do. And the arguments that they come up with are mostly lame, but it has to do with psychological manipulation. You know, the trying to impugn someone's intelligence or, sanity is the number one thing. And the Jews use it to great effect. So, If Jews can pretend to be white and tell you what to do, and if you don't do what they are telling you to do, then you must be stupid or crazy. Well, that same technique can be used by white people even better, because they are peers. they are part of our group for real. They're not pretending. And it's just that it doesn't come as naturally to them. It's not as characteristic of white people to use those kind of arguments. And honestly, I think, if whites just had to deal with whites making those kind of arguments, it would be much easier to just shrug them off and tell them to go jump in a lake, you know? And that's what I don't have any trouble doing that. In fact, I just do it now with Jews as well. Whereas with Jews, this is the kind of doublethink that, whites get into is Jews are white. And so we have to be tolerant and allow them into our organizations and our society, share our society with them. But there are also special, snowflakes and victims that we have to respect. And, the two simultaneous thoughts, those two contradictory thoughts are held in people's heads at the same time. It causes a great amount of cognitive dissonance, but people seem able to deal with it because they look around, they see everybody else doing that as well.
Well, yeah, you're not going to question what everyone else accepts. They've done social experiments on that, you know, where people will just say they believe something that's obviously not true because everyone else around them is saying it.
Yeah, or an authority figure too. Yeah, I've seen, I haven't done nearly as much research into psychology as I should probably. But then again, I'm kind of getting to the point where I don't really need to, for my own benefit, I don't need to research any new areas because I kind of already know what I'm going to find there. It's, and I don't need to convince myself any further. It's more like, nowadays I'm spotting, meta patterns and particular tactics that, I think are important and critical. But they are so effective because there is not much that can be done to counter them. So, it's kind of difficult to come up with, you know, not just exposing the tactic, but then what do we do about it? Okay, so fine. You know, they do these psychological tricks to us. How do we counter it? Well, the most basic thing that I could say is this, you know, noticing the Jews and basically talking about, that's why talking about the Jews is important. If you don't talk about them, if you don't notice them, if you don't point them out when they spread their toxin, then they are taken as white, and they are, then it lends more weight to that stupid argument that we're doing this to ourselves. Jared Taylor was also in that respect the inspiration for Kevin McDonald following that line of argument and the pathological altruism argument, but also this use of suicide terminology. You know, Jared Taylor was basically pretending Jews are white. Jews, they look like whites. And so we're doing this to ourselves. It actually makes more sense. It's more logically consistent when somebody like Jared Taylor makes that argument because he's pretending that Jews are white. And so that's what he means when he says us. It's all of us that are doing this to ourselves. But it, of course, it falls apart. And when he's pressed on the issue, that it's actually the Jews that are hostile towards whites rather than vice versa, that's when he just outright defends the Jews and says, oh, no, the Jews aren't responsible. They're actually, okay. And it's white people who are unhealthy and, have this pathological altruism thing. Anyway, I think we've beaten that dead horse, double dead.
I guess the only point I'll put on the end is my idea of why I think these discussions are important is there are always new people coming in, and you don't want new people getting sucked into the Luke Ford alt-Jew sphere and staying there for any length of time. Also, the reality is the best thing we can do right now is create a culture of anti-Semitism, for lack of a better way of expressing it. What the Jews do, they do through Crypsis. If we create a society where more people are aware of the Jews, more people are cognizant of the Jews, it will actually practically impede their ability to function. You know, if we make a society where it's actually a detriment to take money from the ADL, to take money from, you know, AIPAC when you're a politician, that's when things will actually start to change.
Yeah, I agree. Raising awareness is necessary. I'm not a fatalist. I don't think that basically nothing we do matters. If I did, I wouldn't bother blogging. I wouldn't bother doing podcasts. I wouldn't, you know, bother talking about this stuff. I do think it matters. It's more of a personal struggle, really, at this point I'm at. Just, you know, I've gone pretty far, pretty deep down the rabbit hole, and I just keep finding more and more of the same stuff, convinced myself. But you're right. There are new people coming along who didn't realize all this stuff, and it helps them to, I've said this before, I think I said it was to Luke Ford just recently, that, what I want to do and what I think I've done is help other whites just sort of leapfrog ahead and not have to go through months or years of research into things, that you basically give it to them on a platter. I mean, I benefited from that. The stuff that I was reading that changed my mind about what was going on, that opened my eyes to it, was produced by skeptics, critics of Jews that, in previous generations who had done the hard work, to get the word out there despite the, censorship and hardships of doing that. So, but that's why I make an effort to put it down in a place and collect it and keep it permanent, you know, keep it online rather than just, you know, spewing out a trail of comments on the internet and having them disappear. That's what basically turned me off to Twitter when I was finally banned from it. I was hesitant to get on Twitter for years because I figured that they were just going to ban me. And then I finally got on there and dipped my toe in the pool and saw that it was actually a good place where you could share information and say what you wanted to say, and they weren't censoring anyone. But when the hammer came down finally, it was like a wake-up call that not only did I not have access to Twitter, but it was all of the things that I had done while I was there were just gone. You know, all of the clever little things that I had typed in were now just disappeared. And I didn't like that feeling. I didn't like that waste of effort that I felt at that. I put effort into what I think about and what I say and the way I do it. I want it to last. I want it to have an impact. I don't want it to just go off into the ether. I'm not just talking to myself. So.
No, yeah, I understand, you know, the urge not to jump back on there or jump on Gab, because Gab's liable to crash any day, especially with the whole doxing thing. Now Gab may get into legal trouble for their platform being used for that. I would definitely say, you know, keep your blog up. Of course, you intend to do that. And I'm sure there are people that have already done it, but have taken your podcast and put them on other sites too, so that way they're floating around all over the internet, kind of like what's been done with Scott Roberts' videos over the years.
Yeah, I've seen that, and I that gratifies me too, to see somebody has taken the time to take one of my podcasts and put it up on YouTube or post it in other places, and I'm glad for that. I don't I've known other people are more resentful of that or more controlling about that. They want to be the sole place where people get their podcasts from or something. But no, I'm happy that the information just gets out there. I don't even care if I get credit for it, because I'm not doing this for credit. I'm not, I'm doing it to satisfy an itch in my own soul. Not for credit.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll wind down here. One thing I did want to bring up to you, even though it's a little off topic, just because you're someone that, like me, is interested in the ancient genetic stuff. I've heard it pushed for a few corners of the internet, and recently I've heard Horus the Avenger, disturbingly enough, reference it like he believes it. What are your thoughts on this whole Neanderthal hypothesis that Jews are Neanderthals? Because that theory was literally started by the Jew Michael Bradley, who first wrote the anti-white book The Iceman something, and then wrote the book Chosen People from the Caucasus Mountains.
I don't think it's true. I think that the basic science of it was kind of a shock when it came out about 10 years ago or something, that modern Europeans have some small percentage, something like 1-3% Neanderthal DNA. And that was what they were discovering. And it's, they've since done more detailed analysis of ancient skeletons, and they think they've isolated that the mixing events must have happened something like 40,000 years ago. And maybe there was another one either slightly a couple of tens of thousands of years before that. Anyway, I don't know what to believe because I'm not doing the DNA analysis myself. All I'm doing is reading other people's words about it. I'm skeptical, of course, of any Jew whose opinion I read. And I think that there is spin that's being put on the narrative of that's coming out of race science developments. And the DNA, ancient DNA especially, I have a lot to say about that, but not tonight. But with regards to Neanderthals, I think that the most important takeaway from the standard view of the recent Neanderthal discoveries is that it's just another way in which Europeans are different from Africans, from Negroes. You know, the original out of Africa narrative was that we're all Africans. Our race developed, one race, the human race, the migrating mixing nigger race. We formed about 60,000 years ago and left Africa and spread out all over the world and replaced all of the previous hominins that had occupied those areas, the Homo erectus and whatever other cavemen were still in the area. And the reality is that narrative is collapsing now because, well, for too many reasons to get into the details, but the Neanderthal thing is one of the reasons, because what it demonstrates is that we're not the same race, because even if we were when we left Africa 60,000 years ago, and it looks like it was a lot longer than that, the speciation has been going on for longer than that. And the crossing with what scientists have always considered a separate species, that Neanderthal is not the same species as Homo sapiens. Even if they want to pretend that whites, blacks, and yellows are all the same race, they have never tried to pretend that Neanderthals were. Now they are, because they've seen that, well, basically they've found out that we didn't just replace and exterminate all of the other previous hominins, but mixed this is the way they describe it. They say all non-Africans have some Neanderthal in them. What they're saying there is Europeans and Asians have a small amount of admixture of Neanderthal. It's worse than that, or better than that, depending upon how you look at it. Asians also, some Asians have a mix of another archaic hominin called Denisovans. And then there's Southeast Asian islanders and Pacific islanders that actually have some other, even more exotic and older archaic DNA in them. And in Africa, they not only don't have Neanderthal, but they have their own mixture with some archaic, one or more archaic African species that Europeans and Asians don't have. So, you know, the bottom line is that Asians are different from Europeans, are different from Africans. We are not all the same species. We all have different mixtures of different heritage, different genetics. And they are trying desperately to somehow spin this. As I said, the name I've given it to the narrative, the spin that they try to put on it is the one race, the migrating mixing nigger race. It's sort of they're trying to continue the out of Africa, the point of the out of Africa narrative, which is to mislead us that we're all the same and therefore we have no right to exclude anyone from our countries, no right to have our own countries that we run for ourselves and for our own benefit. And the developing science, the ongoing revelations coming out of biology and genetics is that that's not true. We are actually distinct biologically and genetically, and they're just trying to patch up their broken narrative and replace it with a new narrative that achieves the same ends, that basically tells us we're all cheddar men, we're all black, and so therefore you know, we're always migrating, we're always mixing, and so therefore we shouldn't resist the current ongoing invasion of Europe and the United States and Australia and so forth.
Yeah, it's total twisting things on their heads. You know, they will try to compare what's happening today, what happened back then, and they'll try to argue, oh, race mixing is natural, it's good, it's always happened. Probably what happened between Neanderthals and Homo sapiens sapiens, in most cases, probably was rape. I mean, that's probably what it was.
Yeah.
People falling in love or in interracial romances. No, throughout most of history, it was probably rape and slavery.
Yeah, and war and invasion and slaughter. And, you know, it was very brutal. And that's what's remarkable about what's happening today is because our brains are so addled by this media narrative that diversity is our strength and they're going to enrich us, and we've got to, you know, it's the moral imperative is to let these people who come to our countries, that there isn't more violence than there is. That's what's remarkable. And that's kind of the point that people are getting at when they say, no, this is white people's fault, we're not resisting. That's what, how it seems on the surface is we're not resisting, but back to my point about white flight, it's like, well, we did resist. We do resist to a certain extent. And there are people who snap and lash out, violently. But, there will be more too. And that's, I see kind of the metaphor that I've referred to before is logjam. That part of what I try to do is unjam the logs. And, you know, meanwhile, I notice that what Jews, both Jews and alt Jews, are up to is making sure that the logjam stays in place so that white people don't awaken, so that white people don't become conscious, don't organize, and think collectively, think and act collectively.
Right. It's still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I guess, was there a time limit or something we hit?
I don't know. It crashed out. Did you hear what I said?
I missed it. No.
I was saying that, you know, Jews like Halsey and the alt Jew, they claim to be pro-white, but they don't have a good thing to say about anyone in the movement. You know, they criticize Enoch and Spencer. Apparently, did the alt Jews, you know, no one's doing it right.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. And their main, I'm getting an echo. Their main concern is anti-Semitism and blaming the Jews too much. You know, you shouldn't talk about the Jews. It's pretty transparent what their agenda is, what their interests are, that their Jewish interests, they're what's best for the Jews. Even if they don't say it explicitly, that's their main concern. That's why they're involved. That's why they wear their Jewishness on their sleeve. They're the Jewish policeman that's going to, you know, be there to make sure things are okay for the Jews, things are safe for the Jews.
Well, Frame Game said it literally. He literally said, I think it's good for the Jews if we talk about the JQ.
Yeah, he's particularly insidious because what he does, because he's the most calm, reasonable, and realistic. He actually does describe what the Jews are doing and how they do it, the tactics and manipulative you know, the ins and outs of their manipulative techniques. And yet at the same time, his whole goal is to basically moderate, to perpetuate the relationship so that the Jews can continue to Jew. And, you know, it comes through in his he describes the Jews as white, as the most privileged white people of all. That's how he talks about the white privilege versus Jewish privilege contrast. Is he tries to put a round peg in a square hole by saying, which is half true, say, you know, Jews are the most privileged white group. But it's a lie in that Jews don't really see themselves as white. And it's exactly this privilege question or this privilege rhetoric where it becomes obvious that you can talk about white privilege and have no problem whatsoever, no objection from Jews or even from most alt Jews. But the second you say Jewish privilege and point out that a lot of what's mistaken as white privilege is actually Jew privilege, that's when the Jews will say, oh no, that's not what this is. You're not allowed to say that. Yeah, I've paid attention to that in the past. I've seen, I think it was Julia Ioffe, that actually wrote a book back in early 2016. It came out, might have been early 2017. Anyway, she focused on this problem of the rhetoric against white privilege. She wasn't worried about white people being harmed by it. She was worried that it might splash over to Jews, because obviously Jews are seen as white by most people or many people. And the next logical step after you've accepted that there is such a thing as white privilege and that whites should be criticized for it is to say, hey, what about Jews? And she thought that this would eventually boomerang. And actually, she didn't even use that kind of terminology. She didn't even acknowledge basically that the whole white privilege rhetoric thing came from Jews. It was a form of attack made by Jews, and what I call whitewashing of Jew privilege. The special treatment that Jews get is sometimes explained away as, well, just special white treatment. The Jew domination of Wall Street, the Jew domination of Hollywood, the Jew domination of Silicon Valley. In most mainstream accounts, you'll see it's whitewashed. It's basically described as if white people control Wall Street and Hollywood and Silicon Valley. And she didn't, like most Jew critics of Jewing, they don't ever really acknowledge that the problem that they're complaining about has anything to do with Jewing. But in her case, she was, you know, that's why she was doing what she was doing. She was worried it might somehow harm the Jews eventually. So anyway, that's frame games is the kind of Jew who, if you understand that he's a Jew, you can listen to what he's saying, but you don't need to listen to what he's saying because it's the sort of things that you would already realize. And for the newbies that don't understand the Jews so well and don't understand the history so well, he's very attractive. And they want to listen to him because, after all, here's one of the good Jews. He's telling me what the Jews are doing, and he's allowed to do that because he's a Jew. And isn't that great? You know, it's like the same reason the Tea Party types put blacks up on the podium and applaud extra hard for them, you know, to demonstrate that they're not really racist. It's the same psychology.
Yeah, him and Frame Game, I think. Frame Game and Matt's Arsemite, I think, are the two that actually scared me the most and are what got me kind of into action, you know, doing videos and talking about the good Jew problem. Halsey, he's unlikable. Luke Ford, he's doing whatever he's doing. It was Matt's Arsemite and Frame Game, to a lesser extent, it was later I found him, were the ones that were actually making good-sounding arguments that I could see suckering people in.
Yeah, and moderating people, you know, neutering the argument. I don't want this to go on. I don't want to find some modus vivendi with the Jews. I don't think that that's what's best for the white race. It's not what's going to work in the end. It's I would rather polarize and drive it more extreme than to moderate. And I never would have said that to begin with. I always thought of myself as like a conservative, when I was younger, but it's, it's really the experience and learning what I've learned that makes me realize that conservatism is the problem. You know, the white tendency to want to build and maintain civilizations, which makes us so great in that way, left to our own devices, is actually working against us when we are parasitized as we are, because now we are maintaining our society for the benefit of not us, of aliens. And that's, I think it will collapse on its own. You know, people will come up with whatever reason to not participate, and will be pushed out to a certain extent too, if they resist in any way. But why not help it along too? And it, that's not what, what the frame games type Jews, those smooth talking Jews are not after that result at all. They want us to moderate and just find some way to, you know, talk sense into the Jews so that we can all live in a, you know, go back to the 1980s or the 70s or whatever time, period of time he idolizes.
Yeah, at best, there are Jews that want to maintain a stable food source for a little longer.
No, I think that they shoot higher than that. And that's one of the secrets of their success, is they don't just...
No, I meant the alt-Jews.
Yeah, you mentioned Halsey. Yeah, I don't have a very high opinion about him. I don't think he's very effective at what he does. He's a little bit too ham-fisted about it, and too, he makes it too obvious what he's doing.
Yeah, he's even by Jewish standards, he's bizarrely unlikable. It's
no, he's half. He's a Mischling. That's why he's not as smooth talking as the frame games Jew.
He's a Mischling, but I also think he's doing some kind of goy face. He's like acting up or hamming up this kind of image of a white, you know,
the patriot,
conservative.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree.
Yeah. Well, we've been on here for about 2.5 hours, so is there anything else you want to add?
No, Norman, I'm talked out. I'm getting hoarse even. It's, but it was good talking to you. I should have let you talk more often. One thing I wanted to ask you before we go, even if this, whether this makes it in the podcast or not, I don't care. I wanted to ask you how did you come up? I mean, I vaguely associate you with Bugs, with Bob Whitaker and coming out of that movement. Is that what your background is?
That's where I started. Yeah, I got red-pilled on with the Horace the Avenger podcast. I was moving in that direction, but that's really what made me go all the way. And yeah, on Twitter for a long time, that's all I would do was white genocide memes. You're actually one of the voices that got me more like, we need to be talking about Jews here.
Yeah, well, good. I'm glad. I thought that was how I knew you and recognized you. But it wasn't something I could put my finger on exactly and say for sure. So thanks for confirming that. But I'm glad I had that effect. That was one of the things that annoyed me about the Bob Whitaker mantra and some of the people in that group that were very resistant to discussing the Jews. I remember arguing with some of them at one point, and it just seemed like common sense to me. If you're going to talk about a problem, if you're going to talk about the symptoms, you need to talk about the cause as well. Otherwise, what you're doing, you could argue that it's like at least increasing awareness. But the goal in the end is to cure the problem, to end the problem, not to just complain about the symptoms forever. And it played, I thought, the mantra thing and the white genocide, the approach that some of them took of deliberately wanting to not talk about the Jews, tended to play then into this suicide meme tendency. That is, if you talk about whites as having basically these complaints, but you don't talk about where the complaints come from, what the source of the problem is, then it seems like whites are the source of the problem because we're complaining. So.
Right.
I'm glad that you came around and some others have too.
One thing I've always wanted, I don't know if it can be memed, but I always thought kind of Scott Roberts uses the phrase the Jewish agenda of white genocide. I've used the expression the Jewish war on whites. I really wish that those would take off to kind of replace just what hashtag white genocide.
Yes, I agree. Bill Rise used to call it that too, the Jews white genocide agenda. And I've used that term more often. I've used the term the Jew war on whites. Yeah, I agree. It's like there's two parts to it, and that's the point I often make. And especially what's bizarre about people coming and accusing me of monomania, of just focusing on the Jews, wanting to blame everything on the Jews, is my point is it takes two to tango here. That it's not just whites destroying ourselves for no good reason whatsoever because we're just born to suicide. There's an adversary. There's an enemy. There's a pathogen causing our pathology. And that's my main point. Not that whites are blameless or whatever. It's even, you know, beyond blame. It's like I'm with my kind and for my kind. I want to see my kind go on. And, you know, personally, I'm conflicted about it, just doomed personally, but I can still want the best for the group that I come from.
Right, and you've done a lot of good. I actually want to thank you not only for your influence on me, but just the good you've done for our people as a whole. You know, I know that you have your personal issues, but I want you to know that you've done a lot more good for our race than harm.
Yeah, I don't know. I try. I don't know how much longer I can go. I'd like to get to the point where this is my kind of thinking, my way of seeing things becomes the norm rather than, the exception. And, that would make me very happy.
Well, the good news is it doesn't seem like the alt-Jew thing is catching on, even in the more comedic side of the alt-right, like TRS and stuff, that they're not buying into it.
Yeah, I think that awareness of the Jews, even if it's just from mocking them on 4chan and not even really taking it seriously, it exposes them. And that's the, there's that saying about, you know, sunlight, it cures whatever, you know, exposure to sunlight cures many ailments. And in this case, it's true too, that exposing the Jews for what they are goes a long way toward it at least puts you on the right footing to being able to deal with the problem. As long as you try to pretend that they don't exist, or that what they're doing doesn't matter, that it's entirely within us to solve the problem, you're not going to solve the problem because it's not entirely just about you being a stronger person or a better person. It's also about recognizing that you have somebody who's actively undermining you, somebody who's actively an antagonist against all of your plans. It's bad enough when you have a real pathogen, not a real pathogen, but what most people think of as a pathogen, a little microbe, a little bug that infects you and gives you a cold or gives you some other disease that, even though that thing doesn't think and can't fight you on your own level, it's hard enough to deal with them. And it's really a point I made just recently. It's not even a technological, or it's not a psychological problem that we have to fight them. We would fight them in any way we could, and it's just really technology that limits us to just trying to exterminate them entirely. But when it comes to Jews and other human beings that are, or humanoids that are similar enough to us, we are also susceptible not just to the technological limitations, but to the psychological limitations, the psychological tricks, the webs that they weave to, and the roads that they, the dead ends that they lead us down to confuse us and to keep us ineffective and ensnared, enslaved in our minds first. You know, a lot of people who talk about slavery realize that it's a big part of it is in the slave's own mind. And that's the first thing that has to be broken. The chains in your own mind have to be broken.
Yes. Very much so. If I could sum up the problem in as few words as possible, I'd just say Jews have basically put whites in a mental prison.
Yeah, that's what Jew Sharia or Semitical correctness is. It's this, and the fact that most whites don't even realize that it comes from Jews or benefits Jews and that it's anti-white. They don't even think that deeply about it. They just kind of bristle at it. They realize it, they don't like it. They sense they don't like it because they realize that it's like a minefield, that they could say the wrong thing at any time in their job or in some social setting, and it would be like a landmine going off and hurting them, and they don't like it.
Yeah. Well, I guess that's all I can think of. The only question we got a few times in the chat was mentioning Frame Game, and we did talk about him. So thank you for coming and speaking with me. Again, thank you for everything you've done in general. I hope it wasn't too hard to speak, for 2.5 hours, but I'm glad we did it, and I think we made a lot of good points.
I think it's going to be harder to listen to. I was pretty repetitive. A lot of the things I said, I said multiple times, and I don't like that about this particular discussion. But I did enjoy talking to you, Norvin, and I'll be glad to talk to you again in the future, too, if we have some subject you'd like to discuss. But yeah, I'm pretty tired, so let me go and, I'll see you again soon.
Good night.
All right. Good night.